and 42. Liz Brown is not here today. She will be back after 2007, so she'll probably be back on Wednesday, I would say. But up next, we've got the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
Time now for another edition of the Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown. Views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or advertisers of WGNU Radio. This broadcast is a production of Norman Broadcasting Company, Incorporated, and WGNU Radio, and is intended solely for the information and entertainment of our listening audience. Any rebroadcast, transcribing, recording, or other use of this material without the expressed written consent of Norman Broadcasting Company, Incorporated, and WGNU Radio is strictly prohibited. We ask that you govern your calls within the bounds of brevity and good taste. And now, the wake-up call with Liz Brown.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, tell me, sisters. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, tell me, sisters.
Time for us to use our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing your wound. That's the blow. That's the blow made.
Revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, how can you stand?
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal. Yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
And now it's the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 910 WGNU.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
So we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Welcome, 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 welcome to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much to talk about. 454-0400 is the phone number. And if you want to toll-free long-distance me, real easy, 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. Any kind of, every kind of, all kinds of ways. Get up. Get to me. We have much to talk about. Don't forget, we are broadcasting live on the World Wide Web at www.wgnu.net. So those are your choices. Those are your options. Let's handle our business. I was just reading a news story about how John Hopkins Hospital was responsible for determining whether, I believe it was a brain cancer. A patient had brain cancer, and they took a sample, and the sample was supposed to be tested. And the sample was lost. And now the patient is suing the hospital. And the patient is concerned that it was cancerous. The hospital is saying, well, it's our fault, but it's probably not cancerous. But you wonder, and I wonder as an attorney, what are what can the patient do? What can you do to fight and protect yourself? The climate that we are living in today, we just here in the state of Missouri, our legislatures are putting on the fast track legislation to reduce the amount of punitive damages to hospitals and to nursing homes to $250,000. Recently, the Congress, I believe, was able to change class action suits so that it makes it very difficult for classes to be put together. Makes it very difficult for class action suits to be effective, given now that they're going to go to federal courts. It makes it very difficult that the changes that are going on in the name of reform seem to make it more and more difficult for the average citizen out here to fight against large entities that have all of the resources. I wish I could tell you that I'm going to bring you good news in today's story, but no, I'm not. It's worse than perhaps many of you have known. I have with me as a guest this morning Jillian Aldebaran. She's with the Council and she is the Council and Communications Coordinator for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joining us from Washington, D.C. Jillian, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
You're not bringing us good news here.
No, unfortunately, I'm not.
Well, talk to us about something, that protections that consumers may have no idea that they're giving up.
Well, it's a question of binding mandatory arbitration clauses. As you just mentioned, we've seen in the news that recently Congress has foreclosed a lot of the rights to join together in class actions. They are now considering, or they will soon consider, legislation to reduce the ability to sue in the case of medical negligence. But what's happening every day to consumers across the board, and this affects every single adult in the United States.
And I think that's the really big part of the story, is that nobody is untouched by what you're getting ready to tell us about.
Exactly. If you have a credit card, if you have a telephone, you buy a car, HMOs, summer camps, pet grooming, nursing homes, you name it, in virtually all consumer contracts, there are clauses that require you to give up your right to go to court to seek justice in the event of a dispute with the company.
And explain to us how that happens.
Well, actually, it's a question of arbitration, which is an alternative method of resolving disputes. Instead of going to court, both parties to the dispute go to an arbitrator. And it's a formal hearing. This is not mediation, where someone encourages both parties to compromise and come up with a solution. No, this is, the arbitrator is like a judge, but this is a private, for-profit, and secret, in fact, because the proceedings are confidential, legal system. And these clauses requiring you to do that are in that tiny fine print, you know, like the 8-point font and 9-point font in those contracts that you sign whenever you buy a car or you get a credit card. Sometimes you don't even sign them. Sometimes you just get that as an insert with your statement. When you get your credit card bill, for instance, have you ever seen that insert that says change terms and conditions?
Or? Right. And it's 12 pages, and it is that 8-9 font page of words.
Exactly. And if you're like me, and I'm an attorney even, but, you know, you just take these things and you throw them in your file cabinet and you throw them away.
Yeah, you don't read them. I'm an attorney. You don't read them.
Exactly. And even if you did read them, you wouldn't have a lot of recourse. In fact, you never actually sign those agreements.
But you're bound by
them. Opt-out agreements. So they say, well, tell us by, March 1st, whatever it is, if you do not agree with this, and one of the provisions is, if we have a dispute, you have to submit it to binding mandatory arbitration. You do not have the right to go to court at all. You give that up. If you don't agree with it, just let us know, and we'll cancel your credit card.
So they've got you.
They've got you, and in some cases, it's, some of the more egregious cases, I think, are even the employment cases, because you, as an employee, could be required to do this just in the fine print of your personnel policy.
And they're called BMAs, Binding Mandatory Arbitration. It means that you are absolutely bound to it, that you have no recourse to it, and it is a done deal.
Absolutely. And the arbitrators that we are talking about...
Are they lawyers? Are they judges?
Oh, they're not judges, no. Sometimes they are lawyers, but they are not required to be lawyers. They come from the corporate community. So they are generally corporate insiders, corporate executives, corporate attorneys.
And
they do not have to follow the law. They do not have to know the law, in fact. There is no precedent setting. You know, in our system of justice, we have laws that are written by legislatures, and we have laws that are made by courts, by judges. These laws are not made by arbitrators. There's no way of following arbitration decisions at all, because they're entirely confidential. In fact, only the businesses who are the repeat users of arbitrators get to look at and track what the decisions are, so that they can choose, in fact, the arbitrators that are, preferential to their interests.
Jillian, this just cannot possibly be true. This just absolutely can't possibly be true.
Everyone says, but in fact, it is true. You know, we've just joined a campaign. More than 24 consumer groups and public interest groups have joined a campaign to try and eliminate binding mandatory arbitration clauses in all kinds of contracts. And as part of that campaign, we had a press conference last week where a woman who worked for 32 years as a nursing technologist in a hospital refused to sign a binding mandatory arbitration agreement that she was given just 5 years before she was ultimately fired. She was fired after 32 years. It was clearly, as far as she was concerned, a case of discrimination. We do have discrimination laws. She wanted to sue the hospital based on race and age discrimination, but she was required to arbitrate. She took it to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
If she didn't sign the binding arbitration agreement, why was she required to go to arbitration?
What the court ruled, this is the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, because unfortunately courts have not been very sympathetic to plaintiffs who come before them and say, look, I don't want to be bound by this. Look, I've given up my constitutional rights. In some cases, we're talking about people who cannot read, people who do not have the mental capacity to enter into a contractual agreement. Doesn't matter. The 11th Circuit Court decided that, well, what she could have done was quit. That was the only way that she wouldn't have been bound by this binding mandatory arbitration agreement. And since she did not quit, she was bound.
This is just absolutely mind-blowing. That there are a couple things that are going through my head, Jillian. We have these complaints by large corporations, by insurance companies, by medical institutions, that the legal system, the court system, is so unfair and they cannot get redress because of all of these major lawsuits that are going on. But if BMAs, binding mandatory arbitration clauses, are in such widespread use, they have nothing to worry about.
Well, they don't have a lot to worry about, no.
We're going to have a court system that...
We would maintain that the deck is stacked against the little guy. You know, the justice system is set up to level the playing field. And arbitration could work, for instance. I mean, there's nothing wrong with arbitration in principle if it's not forced on you and if you don't have to sign away your right to it even before a dispute arises. You know, there is such a thing as voluntary arbitration. People are always free to arbitrate if they want to. But to give up your right to go to court beforehand is a very serious issue. I mean, it puts you in a position where you're just not going to get any redress.
And then I just want the audience to be clear about arbitration. Arbitrators don't have to know or follow the law. They don't have to write an opinion. They are not legally accountable for errors. They are not required to take legal precedent into account and are rarely subject to oversights by the court. And they're secret.
And they don't even have to issue written opinions.
And what about the awards that people receive after arbitration?
Well, actually, you know, the plaintiffs prevail, or I'm saying plaintiff, that's really in a court system, but the individual with the complaint prevails really in a very, very small percentage of these suits. I think about 80% of them are decided in favor of the company.
Do you take a lawyer in with you when you go to arbitration?
Yes, you can take a lawyer in with you.
But the lawyer just must be just stark raving mad when they walk out.
One of the problems is finding a lawyer who will agree to represent you in an arbitration, because the awards, as you were just getting at this, the awards are so limited compared to the awards you would receive in a court or that a jury would give you, that it's just not financially feasible for a lawyer to take your case.
But if a lawyer did decide, for whatever reasons, to take the case, lawyers operate under the understanding and in the arena where there are rules, the rules are supposed to be followed, and if the rules aren't followed, then you can challenge them, and then if you lose, then you can look at what happened and challenge that. What do you do as a lawyer when you walk into an arbitration room?
Well, you know, lawyers who represent clients in arbitration know the system that they're going into, and there are rules and procedures that are established by each of these arbitration associations. There are actually three major groups in the United States that perform arbitrations. It's the American Arbitration Association, National Arbitration Forum, and the Judicial Arbitration and Mediation Services. You know, these are the major groups. It's not the only groups, and they all have their own rules and procedures that you can look at and see how they function. But in terms of the options available to lawyers, even, you know, discovery, for instance, where you have the right to see documents that the other party has to prove that they have committed some wrongdoing against you, you don't really have that right in arbitration. You can, but it's very, very limited.
And is there a website where people can go to find out more about this?
There certainly is, and I'm glad you asked. There are several, actually. The website is givemebackmyrights.org, www.givemebackmyrightsaltogether.org, And that website will give you a really good overview of this whole binding mandatory arbitration agreement, and it has links to all kinds of other really good information on this. There is another website that we've launched that is www.callbeforeyoubuy.com. Callbeforeyoubuy.com. And that website is specifically geared toward people who want to purchase a car but do not want to be forced into a contract that has a BMA clause in it.
Because you can find also on the website places where you can go that don't have these BMAs in them.
Well, what we are doing is we are encouraging car dealerships, for instance, to let us know if they are, obviously we're discouraging them from using these BMA clauses across the board. Those that don't, we are encouraging to let us know who they are so that we can post their names on the website. Now, you know, we can't really encourage people to buy cars from specific dealers or take out credit cards with specific banks or credit unions because there might be other things involved, you know, beyond whether or not they require binding mandatory arbitration. We don't know what the rest of their practices are like. However, we can at least let consumers know where they can find the services that they're looking for without having to sign away their right to go to court.
And how is our Congress responding to BMAs? What are senators, what are Congress people saying? Is this an issue that's resonating with them?
There have been bills that have come up from time to time. A few years ago in 2003, a law was passed when car dealers, it's so interesting because the car dealers have these BMA clauses in their contracts with consumers, but in fact they were trying to fight their own BMA clauses by which they were bound to auto manufacturers. And they did that back in 2003, and the law was passed that outlawed those clauses for the car dealers. So there have been some initiatives. There was, in last Congress, there was a bill that would have prohibited BMA clauses in the poultry farming and livestock farming clauses because those franchisees, that's another really terrible industry, they are bound also by these clauses.
And one more question, Jillian. Is arbitration free, or do consumers have to pay for the arbitration that they're
bound? Oh, my goodness,
bound?
It's extremely costly. And, you know, this is yet another one of the reasons that it is so unfavorable to consumers. It discourages them from bringing complaints because it could cost you a minimum of $750 just to file your complaint, and you're paying arbitrators $300 and up an hour as a fee.
So you're paying the arbitrator up to $350 an hour, and an arbitrator, the history of arbitrators is that they represent the industry, they represent the business interests.
That's right, exactly. In fact, it's kind of interesting because arbitration was conceived in the first place as being a quicker and less formal process of adjudicating a claim, but in fact it turns out to be, it's much quicker because it doesn't happen a lot of the time, but it's far, far more expensive. You know, Public Citizen actually did a study comparing the cost of bringing a suit in court and the cost of arbitration back in 2002, and it found that, for instance, here's an example. To file a case for like a $60,000 employment discrimination claim in Cook County, Illinois, it costs $221. The same case would have been brought before the National Arbitration Forum costing almost $11,000.
Wow.
That's 5,000% more.
And it's a fair venue.
And the court is a fair venue, yes. And you do have a right to a jury.
And a right to appeal, and a right to see the evidence, and a right to discovery.
Exactly.
Jillian Aldebaran, thank you so much for joining us here on the Wake Up Call. And give out that website one more time, please.
Well, thank you so much for having me. The website is, there are several, there's a www.givemebackmyrights.org, where you can get an overview of all the BMA issues involved. And there is www.callbeforeyoubuy.org. where you can get advice to help you purchase a car.
Very good. Jillian Aldebaran, Counsel and Communications Coordinator for Public Citizens Congress Watch, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Listen, folks, we're going to take
You've
a break.
You've been listening to the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Stick around. We've got more to come following traffic and local commercials. Good morning, St. Louis. 35 minutes after the hour of 6 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by Open from American Express. 40 westbound from McLaughlin through Hanley looks good. Eastbound from 141 through 270, no problems to report there. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79, congestion, but it's still moving on the speed limit. Northbound 270 at 44 looks for heavy volume on either side, but it's still rolling at the speed limit as well. Westbound 270 from 267 to 170 looks good. Northbound 55 from Butler Hill to 270 is on the move. Westbound 5570 on the PSC looks good. Northbound Route 3, that ramp is still moving well. And westbound Kingbridge traffic is on the move as well. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by Open from American Express. Open, how American Express serves small business. To learn more, visit open.com or call 1-800-NOW-OPEN. Now taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and for New Year's Eve. Mostly cloudy today with a high in the 50s. This evening, cloudy, chance of showers after midnight, low in the upper 40s. Saturday, breezy, cloudy, chance of showers in the morning, then occasional showers and a possible thunderstorm in the afternoon. High around the 50s degree mark as well. Then on Sunday, New Year's Eve, the last day of 2006, mostly cloudy, 40% chance of showers with a high in the lower 50s. Currently, we have 43 degrees and some clouds. Lambert Field is reporting clouds and 42. Stay tuned for more of the best of the Wake Up Call. This up next, we'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 7 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
Just like a well-built house needs a good design and plan, so do our lives. This is Sandy.
And this is Bobby.
Two life coaches. Please join us as we take your questions about designing your life. We'll discuss life planning, following through, and the obstacles that get in the way.
This is your weekly chance to get some answers you've been looking for. We hope you'll join us on The Design Life on WGNU every Monday afternoon from 4 to 5.
Prizes awarded on WGNU will be held for pickup at the radio station for 30 days. After 30 days, all items become the sole property of WGNU Radio to be disposed of at our discretion. In the case of event tickets, tickets will be held for 30 days or until the date of the event, whichever comes first. Prizes must be picked up at our studios, which are located at 265 Union Boulevard in St. Louis, unless otherwise specified.
This joy I have, the world didn't give it, and the world can't take it away. Be sure to listen to Joy in Jerusalem each Sunday, time 11 until 12 p.m., with Dr. Evangelist Rosella Burks, presenting Elder William Bailey and Elder Damon Collins, along with other great pastors. Feel the joy every Sunday, time 11 p.m., here on AM 920 WGNU.
Previously on this Lone Ranger program,
I will tell you the advice that a wise woman once gave to me for women looking for a good man. First, you find a dependable, hardworking man who's helpful around the house. Second, you find a loving man who will spoil you and take care of you and never lie to you. And third, you find a thoughtful man who can make you laugh. And most important of all, you make sure these three men never meet each other.
Oh, that's great.
The Sloan Ranger Show, weekdays at 5 o'clock, only on AM 920 WGNU. The Struggle for Fairness on the award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now we take you back to more of the best of the Wake-Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
My my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. And my toll-free long-distance number is 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. Any kind of, every kind of, all kinds of ways, get up, get to me. We have much, much, much to talk about. And this morning, we are going to talk to Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute, joining us from Ottawa, Canada. Apparently, we need to talk about what is happening in the bottled water industry. Tony Clark, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Very good. Tony, I drink, I don't know how many bottles of bottled water a day. Should I be concerned about that?
Well, I think it's time we took a look at that. You're among many people in the United States. About 20% of the people in the United States today go to bottled water as their exclusively for their hydration needs and for their daily drinking of water. And but you know, I think we did need to take a hard look at what is really happening. Whether this is the best way of getting our drinking water. Sometimes people turn to bottled water because they feel that there are problems with the tap system. But when you really look at it across the United States, that the tap system is still a pretty good way of delivering water in general, and the price gouging that goes on as a result of that is horrendous.
Let's take one issue at a time. Let's talk about the concern and the efforts to get people to have the concern that bottled water is somehow better than tap water. You say that Americans should not be concerned about the quality of water that comes out of their taps and bottled water isn't better?
Well, this is it. I mean, there's a certain myth that's being perpetuated that the bottled water has better water quality than tap water, and that's not necessarily the case. Studies have shown, in comparing both tap water and with bottled water and various brands of bottled water, that there are problems in bottled water as well. There have been studies that have shown traces of arsenic and mercury and E. coli to be found in bottled water. The process that is used by some of the bottled water companies does generate certain problems. For example, Coca-Cola uses a process called ozonization, which changes bromides into bromate, and bromate is a carcinogen. And if it's taken at a high count, it can be deadly. So that there are problems here that need to be examined, and we are talking about. We're talking about right across the board that the quality of bottled water needs to be much more rigorously regulated than it is.
It is not rigorously regulated
in the United States at all.
How, when you say that it is not regulated, isn't it regulated the same way that tap water is?
No. There are different standards. The EPA, for the Environmental Protection Agency, has stricter standards with regards to water quality and testing, and then there's much more regular testing of tap water than exists with regards to bottled water. So one really needs to take a look at this. The FDA, the Food, Drug, and Administration, is the agency under which bottled water is regulated, and the FDA really doesn't have very strong regulations and rules, and furthermore, even if it did have those rules, it doesn't have the resources to enforce those rules.
Well, let's back up.
So those are problems that need to be addressed.
Well, let's back up just for a second. Do a compare and contrast of some of the things that happen in that regulate tap water that do not happen in bottled water.
Could you repeat that again? Sorry.
Could you do like a compare and contrast here? You say that the regulations are more strict and water is more regulated that comes out of your tap and it is not in bottles. So what are some of the things that are done to regulate the water, tap water, that are not done to regulate the bottled water?
Well, for one thing, the regulations are take place on a much more active level. You have a testing that takes place on a more regular basis. It's done by
in tap water. We're talking about tap water.
Tap water, yes. And it's done It's done by licensed technicians that examine this much more carefully than you will find with regards to usually the bottled water. The results are available to the public, whereas in the case of bottled water, when it's tested, those results are held by the company. Furthermore, the procedures and timelines to be followed for both microbial and chemical tests are stricter, and there is also the whole question of labeling, whether or not the companies are, I mean, the labeling instructions for bottled water are very weak.
What
do
you mean,
labeling? And it does not require, for example, that you indicate where the source of the water is, where it came from, whether or not it should be refrigerated after opening. Once you open a bottle of water and you put it back in the fridge, you don't put it back in the fridge, there can be real problems with regards to bacterial growth in the water.
Really?
Right.
And there aren't any regulations out there that tell us that mandate that companies tell us that this is so.
That's right.
So when people have the understanding that tap water is not good, bottled water is good, how did they come to these opinions?
Well, there's a certain amount of promotion of that idea. I mean, obviously, people involved in the bottled water industry, their biggest competitor is not so much themselves as it is the tap water system. Still, 80% of the Americans get their daily drinking needs from tap water. So tap water is the one that needs to be, consumer habits with regards to tap water need to be changed. And so therefore, whenever there's an outbreak or a crisis or a problem, you can see that, bottled water industry is able to take advantage of that and to promote the idea that bottled water is a safer alternative to tap water. Now, in some cases, there's no doubt about it. Bottled water is probably a safer alternative to tap water in certain jurisdictions. But this needs to be examined place by place across the United States. The United States still has by and large, a very good public water system, and if anything, that needs to be supported and strengthened. At least it's a cheaper alternative, because the difference between buying a bottle of water, a bottle of 1.5 liter of say Dasani or Aquafina, costs you maybe $1.25, $1.50, whatever anyway, for a 1.5 liter bottle. You turn around and you take that same amount of water from a tap system in, say, New York City, and it's 1/100th of a cent. That's the kind of incredible price markup that exists with regards to bottled water.
How can if consumers have bought into the advertising campaign pushing them, at least here in America, pushing them away from tap water and into bottled water, if they have bought into that, what can a consumer do to protect themselves and make the best choice of particular brand of bottled water? And, Tony, I'm going to have to take a break, but I'd like to come back with that answer to that question, and we'll get to some of the calls, too. I'm talking to Tony Clark, the director of the Polaris Institute, joining us from Ottawa, Canada, and we're talking about bottled water. How safe is it? My name is Liz Brown. This is the Wake Up Call. Stay with me. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the best of the Wake Up Call. We'll have more on the way following these commercial words.
I know the place to shop for all your appliance needs. Sears, 3425 Union, black owned and black operated, Jerome Williams. Sears carries the top six appliance brands, Kenmore, Whirlpool, Maytag, GE, Amana, and Frigidaire. Sears also has the latest in electronics, TVs, VCRs, camcorders, and DVD players. Now, if you find a lower price on an identical branded item with the same features currently available at another local retail store, Sears will match that price plus give you 10% off the difference. That's the Sears Price Match Plus policy. So, save yourself a trip. Stop at Sears first and get a low price promise plus a great selection for your home and garden needs. It's all at your local Sears store right there at 3425 Union, Jerome Williams, 389-9700.
This is Pastor Divine Crusoe. Please join me on Monday evenings from 8 o'clock to 8:30 with Unfolding Destiny Broadcast. This broadcast is designed for those who are sick and shut in, those who are broken and need to be mended, those who are out of their place and cannot find their way, and those who know that their destiny is predicated upon their faith and that it is divine in ministry. So please tune in every Monday evening at 8 o'clock with Pastor Divine Crusoe and Unfolding Destiny Broadcast.
Hi, it's Kevin.
And Sue McCarthy.
Of the Travel Planner Show.
Before you head out for a trip, you want to know how to pack, so check weather at yahoo.com, and then you'll know what to wear when you get there.
Oh, she's so good. The Travel Planner Show, every Saturday afternoon from 2 to 4, here on AM 920 WGNU.
People can't stop talking about the remarkable results they get with their Bowflex Tread Climber machine.
I lost over 20 pounds working out on the Tread Climber.
I've lost almost 10 inches off my waist.
The Bowflex Tread Climber machine combines the stepping motion of a stepper with the walking motion of a treadmill. It's the low-impact way to burn up to twice the calories of a treadmill at the same speed.
It's really strengthened my core, my abs, and there's no impact on my joints.
Call 1-800-888-7635 for a free information. DVD.
I'm in better shape now than I was 20 years ago.
Get a Bowflex Tread Climber machine for no money down and payments as low as $24 a month.
I'm 40 and I am in the best shape of my adult life.
Be lean, be fit, be Bowflex. For a free DVD, call 1-800-888-7635. 1-800-888-7635. On approved Bowflex credit card purchases, monthly payment is 1.5% of the purchase plus any late fees. The number of months you pay and total amount of minimum monthly payments depends on additional purchase and account balances. Call for details.
Hi, I'm Randy Grimm. Join me Friday morning at 11 for Animal Tales on AM 920 WGNU. 2 hours of fur, friends, and fun as we discuss the issues that matter most to you and your companion animals. Animal Tales, Friday morning at 11 on AM 920 WGNU. Woof.
Anywhere in the world at WGNU.net. The award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Now back to the best of the wake-up call. We'll have the news, the traffic, and the weather on the way. At the top of the hour.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number, 454-6609 is my fax. I'm talking to Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute, joining us from Ottawa, Canada, and we're talking about bottled water. And Tony, on the way out, I asked you about what can the consumer do to protect themselves if they decide that they're going to continue drinking bottled water. What should they look for? What should they do?
Well, Liz, you know, I think that I think that people need to. It's not on the question of being able to choose from one brand to another. Although sometimes by looking at the label, you can get some information. The problem is the labeling laws do not provide the information that you really need to make that judgment call individually between different brands. So that's one of the problems I think that's in the wake. But I think that another problem that people we all need to look at is, for example, the fact that this water is put into plastic bottles, and plastic bottles are a problem in and of themselves, because in some cases what happens is that you've got plastic that is non-recyclable, you know, can't be recycled, and that plastic can often pose real problems, because plastic is made of both toxic chemicals on the one hand and fossil fuels on the other. And when you combine that and it's inside the plastic, that the toxic chemicals can, over a period of time, start to leach into the water itself. So those are problems that we need to find out about and know more about if we're going to be able to make this judgment call with regards to bottled water.
Well, if we wanted to, because we live on this fast-paced life, I have to have water with me everywhere to hydrate me. What's the recommendation to an alternative to refilling up my plastic bottle?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important to get a container that you can carry around with you that is doesn't have the problems I just mentioned about the leaching of chemicals into the water itself. So that's the first step. A second step would be to say, well, you know, why can't I just sort of take the water out of my tap and put it into my container and carry it around with me? And if I have problems with the water that's maybe coming out of my tap, then maybe I should put a filtering system on that will help both with the distilling or filtering of the water itself and or possibly even the taste, depending on what kind of a filtering system you can buy.
And also then, and I want to get to some of my calls here, but also we need to talk about what we can do if we want to make other changes in there, because there should be labeling changes made for water, and what can we do to make that happen. Let me get to some of my callers here. Dan, you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, ma'am. I was wondering, I know he said he's from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably not familiar with our city itself. And I was wondering, you know, your delivery system, these pipes in the city of St. Louis, what do you actually think about, you know, they've got to be a little bit contaminated after all these years, because a lot of these houses were built in the 1800s and early 1900s. And I'm wondering, the water system's never been changed as far as I know, so I got to imagine, you know, that these pipes have deteriorated.
That's a great question, Dan. You can do all of the filtering and cleaning of the water at the plant, but it still has to go through the pipes, Tony.
That's right. No, I think that's a very, very valid point. And there's no question that the infrastructure, the piping infrastructure for the water service delivery in our cities throughout the United States, and it's the same thing in Canada, too, in many cases they're getting quite old and they need to be replaced. So there is a considerable investment in that whole area. But you know, we've done calculations and we've shown that the amount of money that people spend in the United States on bottled water every year could contribute to 70 to 75% of all of the costs required to really rebuild the public water system in the United States.
So what are you suggesting?
So what we're pointing out here is that already we're pouring money into bottled water when in fact we could be pouring a lot more of that money back into the rebuilding of our public water systems.
So a tax on water to do that, or just because of the average consumer is not going to make the connection of, okay, if I don't spend buy this bottled water, I'll be able to get my pipes the pipes in my town that make my water safer to drink. They're not going to make that connection because they can't make that connection. So what are you suggesting?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, the first step is awareness, and for people to start to, you know, ask those questions and make those choices themselves. Obviously, you're quite right. There's a number of steps to go through before one even gets to the point of being able to resolve such a problem, the issues like this. But the point is simply this: where do we want to go in the future with regards to our drinking water? Do we want to be put in a situation where the only safe drinking water that we think we can get is from a bottled water system? Or do we say to ourselves, for the long term and the long haul, it is much better that we rethink this and to put a lot more regulations in place with regards to bottled water on the one hand, and secondly, start to think about what it means to really reinvest in the rebuilding of our public water systems?
Question or comment for our guest?
Yes, good morning, Liz.
Good
How
morning.
Are you this morning?
I'm outstanding.
I was very interested in your guest that you had there, and I'd like to say hello to your guest. My question was, now, I see a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but for one moment they were getting their little filtering system and to go on their tap, and it would filter and get some of the residue and the metal portions that come out of the bad pipes and what have you. But I guess that'll probably be our best resort before we'd be able to have the money to change pipes in the system. But I also wanted to know, we do have some services here in St. Louis where they manufacture and make this water. Because I remember one place I worked at Tyler Water Cooler System or whatever, and they made the water and sent the big plastic containers out and what have you. But I believe there's a company here that actually makes this stuff, and they got a little green powder they pour in there and what have you. How safe is that? And
how safe is what?
I thought it was very important that you mention that.
How safe is what, Will?
The water that they actually make here, the bottled water that they actually make here.
Okay.
Because I didn't see anybody wearing any plastic gloves, pouring this little green stuff in it, and this was water that was going into the big plastic bottles that we buy and put in our coolers.
Thanks for your call. What are the regulations? I think what you're saying, Tony, is that we don't have regulations of how bottled water is bottled.
Well, we have very, very minor regulations, and there's a lot more that needs to be, a lot more regulations that need to be put in place. And I think, for example, what the caller is referring to there is, a process that's obviously been going, he observed going on there in St. Louis. And I think that people locally need to ask themselves, well, are there bottled water plants here? Where is it coming from? For example, if you look at Nestle's, and which is the largest bottled water company in the United States in terms of number of products and so forth, they take their water from rural springs and underground and groundwater systems, and they tip it off to their little plants, and they process it, and then they sell it, they bottle it, and sell it.
Stick around for more of the best of the wake up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
People who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Aldinger. Saddam Hussein's days are numbered. The former dictator's attorney says his client will be hanged sooner rather than later, but we're not sure if he's in Iraqi custody already. More from ABC's Terry McCarthy in Baghdad.
There have been conflicting reports from various Iraqi officials about whether or not Saddam Hussein is yet under Iraqi custody. We do know that a senior U.S. official told ABC News in Washington that they would be transferring Saddam in the next 36 hours, which would mean by the end of Friday. Beyond that, nothing is certain, and there has been a lot of speculation. Nothing can be confirmed yet.
Saddam exhausted his final appeal earlier this week. Driving isn't much fun this morning across much of the plains, thanks to another winter storm, the second in about a week. Again, Denver is getting the brunt of it. Mayor John Hickenlooper says they'll try and stay a step ahead of it.
There's quite a wide range in forecasts, but certainly within the range of those forecasts, there is the potential that this storm could be as intense or even more intense than the storm that hit us a week ago.
So far, though, the airport is open. There are private services today for two historic Americans who died this week, one in Palm Desert, California, for former President Gerald Ford, who died Tuesday night. Later today, a public viewing for the nation's 38th president.
With the Marine Corps marching band playing Hail to the Chief, Mr. Ford's flag-draped coffin will be loaded into a hearse tomorrow morning. But first, his body will lie in repose here. The day will begin with a private funeral service open only to the Ford family and VIPs. And then late in the day, the public will be able to pay its respects. Alex Stone, ABC News, Palm Desert, California.
The other service will be at a church outside Augusta, Georgia, for James Brown. The Godfather was soul packed him in yesterday at New York's Apollo Theater, where people cheered his casket as it was taken into the legendary concert venue where the Godfather of Soul made his debut. Former heavyweight champ Mike Tyson is under arrest. Police in Scottsdale, Arizona say they picked him up on drunken driving charges. This is ABC News.
You're on the Ovaltine Nutrition Hotline with nutritionist Felicia Stoller.
Hi, I worry my two teenage daughters aren't getting enough iron. Which milk flavoring provides more iron, Ovaltine or Nesquik powder?
For your girls, I recommend rich chocolate Ovaltine. It provides 20% of the daily allowance of iron, while chocolate flavor Nesquik powder has only 2%. And not only is Ovaltine a rich source of iron, but it has over twice as many vitamins and minerals as Nesquik, so Ovaltine's more nutritious. And kids love the taste of rich chocolate Ovaltine.
More Ovaltine, please!
My husband had a health concern a month ago.
Mr. Thompson, everything looks good.
Oh, thanks, doctor.
It turned out to be nothing, but it got us doing more for our health.
And stretch and bend.
Like morning exercise and taking silver.
Centrum Silver Multivitamin is age-adjusted. It helps protect your health as you age with key antioxidants that help support natural cell repair. Centrum Silver Multivitamin.
Things have sure changed around here.
Our health protection starts with silver.
Take along with a healthy diet and exercise.
No matter what a judge says, Major League Baseball players say they'll do all they can to keep steroid testing secret. Here's ABC's Gil Gross.
The Players Union says it will fight the federal appeals court decision to give prosecutors access to the names and urine samples of about 100 players who tested positive for steroids. Union Chief Donald Fair said Thursday the decision effectively repeals the Fourth Amendment. His case is the players agreed to confidential tests, only to see if there was a need for stricter testing. Though it's been reported this could help the government investigation of slugger Barry Bonds, his lawyer says since Bonds never tested positive, it doesn't do anything at all. Gil Gross, ABC News, Los Angeles.
You're probably thinking about your New Year's resolutions, or at least you're starting to think about them. Well, guys, I hate to tell you this. More of us women will keep ours. A Marist College poll says losing weight, obviously number one for most of us women. Guys, most of you say you're trying to be a better person in 2007. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU Newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Ransmeyer with your WGNU News Update for the 7 o'clock hour. In the news this Friday, a man faces charges in connection with a string of suspected arson fires in North St. Louis. 21-year-old Andrew Franklin is charged with 7 counts of second-degree arson and 7 counts of second-degree burglary. Franklin is suspected in more than a dozen fires in vacant buildings. 4 public hearings on a rate hike request from Ameren UE will take place in St. Louis starting next week. Customers may comment on the rate proposal and bring service-related problems before the Public Service Commission. The first 2 hearings are next Tuesday at 11:30 at the Thornhill branch of the St. Louis County Library and 5:30 at the Wohl Community Center. Other hearings are set for January 8th at 11:30 at the University of Missouri St. Louis and 5:30 at St. Louis Community College Forest Park. The Missouri Highway Patrol will step up patrols on New Year's Eve. Sergeant Al Notham says troopers will especially be on the lookout for drunk drivers.
People need to realize that, you know, you can have 1 or 2 glasses of wine with your meal and feel like you can drive home. If someone asks you, do you feel like you can drive? And you're honest to yourself and you say, yeah, I think I can drive. And you do that. You got to remember that you're rolling the dice even with that, with just a few glasses of wine in your system.
Last year, there were 7 fatalities on Missouri roadways during the New Year's holiday weekend. 151 people were also arrested for driving while intoxicated. Finally this hour, the Blues and Avalanche will open a home-and-home set this evening in Colorado. The teams will meet at 8 p.m. tonight in Denver before heading back to St. Louis for a 7 p.m. game tomorrow at Scott Trade Center. The Blues have earned at least 1 point in each of their last 6 games to boost their record to 10-19-7. Colorado heads into tonight's action with a record of 18-16-2. The Blues and Avs have split 2 meetings this season. This WGNU News Report is brought to you by the Illinois Lottery. Play daily, play nightly, play when you need a smile, play for the rush. No matter how you play, play the Illinois Lottery. Have a ball, have fun, play responsibly. That's your look at local news for the 7 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeyer for Radio Free St. Louis.
Good morning, St. Louis. 7 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by RAD and the American Federation of Musicians. Westbound 40 between McCausland and Hanley, look for normal traffic. Eastbound 40 from 141 through 270 looks good. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79, congestion is still moving better than normal, but it is congested down there. Northbound 270 at 44, no problems to report. Westbound 270 from 367 to 170 looks good. Northbound 55 at Butler Hill End, 270 is on the move. Westbound 5570 into the Poplar Street Bridge. You've got heavy volume from the Illinois Bank. Northbound Route 3 onto the Poplar Street Bridge. That ramp's still open and looking good. Westbound King Bridge from the Illinois Bank through Laclede's Landing. Expect some delays. That is a look at this hour's traffic. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by RAD and the American Federation of Musicians. Season's greetings from RAD and the American Federation of Musicians. Remember, music lives, and so should you. So buckle up and use a designated driver. Learn more at RAD, that's RAD.org. Now, taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and for New Year's Eve. Mostly cloudy day, high in the upper 50s this evening. Chance of showers after midnight with a low in the upper 40s. Saturday, breezy, cloudy, chance of showers and possibility of thunderstorm in the afternoon. The high will be in the 50s. And Sunday, last day of the year, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers with a high in the lower 50s. Currently, we have mostly clear skies, 43 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 43 as well. It's the best of the wake-up call that's up next. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air from the brothers.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. That progress is being made. If you take a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how
can you stand? But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever.
Now more of the best of the wake-up call right here at AM 920 WGNU.
Who need help but can't find it. But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever. More families in trouble. More and more people who need help but can't find it. Struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Welcome back to the wake-up call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much to talk about. We have a lot of budgetary issues that are going on in the state of Missouri. The budgetary issues going on in all states across this country. We are strapped for money, and there are a million reasons why states are strapped for money. And the one consistency, each state may have their own amounts of money that they have to try to find somewhere. The one consistency seems to be that the programs that suffer the most are the programs that fill in the gaps and help people the most. We've heard about the cuts that are going to take place on a national level, the cuts of 150 programs as a result of the budget that was introduced by George W. Bush. And we've talked about it, or talked about on this show, some of those programs that will be affected, how our soldiers will now, our veterans will now have to pay more money for health care. Pay money for health care. Head Start, Pell Grants, the things that help people move forward in life. In some cases, those programs just help you stay in place and not fall behind. One of the areas that we have not had an opportunity to examine in terms of how the budget will impact it, and that's the area of non-profit groups. Nonprofits, the people and the causes that they serve. And to help facilitate that conversation, I have Adam Hughes, the budget policy analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington, D.C. Adam Hughes, good morning.
Hi, Liz. How are you doing?
I'm outstanding. How are you?
Good.
Talk to us about, I don't want to get to the cuts in the for the nonprofits yet. I'd like to start with the setup that is being used to justify these cuts in the nonprofit groups. Can you talk to us about one of the observations that is being, or one of the justifications that's being used by this administration is that overall spending is out of control and we must deal with that. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's not exactly true. So the way that I would respond to it is if you look at the outlays between 1981 and 2000, they ran at about 21% of gross domestic product, which is the best way to measure them over time. And if you look at the last couple of years under the Bush administration, they've actually dropped to about 19% of gross domestic product. So our actual spending overall is less than it was through the Reagan presidency, the first Bush presidency, and Clinton. The kind of counter statistic to that is that our revenue is at its lowest level since the 1950s.
Mm.
And that's really what set up the difficulty with the federal budget right now is that there's so much less money coming in as a percentage of GDP that there's not enough money to spend on the programs that have been going on. So instead of and most of that decrease has come during the Bush presidency because of the tax cuts from 2001-2003. About 48% of our deficit right now is caused by those tax cuts.
Because the tax cuts, in very basic language, reduce the amount of money that's coming into the federal government.
That's exactly right. They drastically reduce the amount of revenue.
Can you illustrate that for us?
Well, the size of the tax cuts alone, I think, is really the illustration of it. The way that Bush proposed them in 2001, I think they were reduced a great deal from that proposal. So they're actually not even as large as he had wanted them to be. And if you want to look at about kind of the across the board amounts that people received, the more money you make, the more you got back in tax cuts. And there is some logic to that in the sense that people that make more money pay more in income tax. But it was not proportionally given back in the tax cut. The proportions that you pay in income tax were skewed greatly in the tax cut and the amount of money that was given back so that you didn't get a percentage back at the same kind of percentage that you paid in.
So let's talk about the impact of these budget cuts on the nonprofits. How are these cuts any different than other cuts that I'm sure nonprofits would never make the argument that they always get the amount of money that they want?
Yeah, they might actually try to make the argument the opposite.
Yeah.
They never get the amount.
They never,
they want.
Right.
Well, the first thing to know is that nonprofit groups around the country get about a third of their funding overall from government, whether it's state or local government or federal revenues. So any cuts to government funding have a very important impact on nonprofits. And this is all sorts of nonprofits, from, you know, direct service providers and people who run homeless shelters and food kitchens and things like that, to universities and hospitals, arts groups, education, after-school programs, all sorts of things like that. So I think some people have an idea of what a nonprofit is, and it's important to realize a lot of things that you think are not nonprofits actually are, and they're affected by this too. The reason these cuts are, I think, different is not necessarily because of the cuts that are happening this year, or that are proposed for this year, I should say, but because of the kind of the budget lays out a sort of an outline for the next 5 years for funding. And it's really the cuts that happen after fiscal year 06, which is the year that we're working on the budget for right now. And the way that they do that is President Bush proposes having spending caps, which are basically an overall amount of spending that certain areas of the budget must be held to. The way that he lays it out is he has a defense category, a non-defense category, and then two transportation categories, highway and mass transit. The highway and mass transit programs categories are separate, but the defense and the non-defense categories are joined together in 2008. And so then they have this one number that the defense and non-defense discretionary spending must stay under. And the defense category keeps going up, and the non-defense, the kind of the discretionary spending that goes to things like education and child care and nutrition assistance and those sorts of programs, is level funded over the next 5 years. And it's hard to tell that by looking at the budget. It's kind of something that we had to search around for in order to find.
So the only spending that goes up is the spending that's on defense?
In the discretionary category cap for defense and non-defense. Yes, that's correct.
And defense gets funded from other places, too, other than discretionary.
Well, that's true, yeah. There's some, but it's also true that there's some programs that fund social service type priorities that are not discretionary programs as well.
Why is this discretionary money so important to take a look at?
Well, the discretionary money is really the bulk of the funding for programs that help nonprofits provide services for people who need help. And it's also the portion of the budget that Congress really has a control over each year. Which is kind of one of the underlying reason why these caps are bad, is because it takes away the ability of future Congresses to determine what the priorities of the country are.
Is this different? Has this been have these caps been in place before?
Caps have in one form or another have been in place before, but I think the caps being proposed now are something that's new and unique, that we haven't really seen. Not only the kind of drastic cuts, non-defense discretionary spending would be cut by 14% over the next 5 years under the caps. But we also haven't really seen an attempt, at least I haven't, to kind of hide the way that the cuts will happen, which is one of the other problems with the budget, is that it doesn't include information on individual programs over the next 5 years.
And it has in the past.
Yes, it has for the last, I think, 15 or so years. And occasionally it's left out. But it's usually the way that the budget is presented, so that people are able to track what the proposal for funding is for programs over time.
Well, and also, even when George Bush said that he was going to cut, that 150 programs were going to be cut, they weren't quickly forthcoming with that information of which programs those were going to be.
That's exactly right, actually. We were contemplating one in our analysis of the budget, the week the budget came out, of going through and trying to pick out the programs that he very publicly trumpeted as being cut or eliminated. And in truth, there's actually more than 150 programs that are cut or eliminated, and we've had difficulty figuring out why those programs, the 150 that he referred to, are on that list.
Can you give us kind of an example of the types of programs that we're talking about that are going to receive cuts?
Sure. Education funding is going to be cut, and that's there's a variety of actual budget lines that are included in education funding. But regular No Child Left Behind K through 12 education will be cut by about $4.6 billion.
But we started with everybody saying that I don't think that there was an educator in America that said that the No Child Left Behind program was ever funded enough to begin with.
That's exactly right. And that's something that there's a Washington D.C. word for that, which is called an unfunded mandate. In No Child Left Behind, the Bush administration has laid out some priorities and some requirements for the states to meet, but they haven't provided any funding to meet those priorities. So it's really put a lot of pressure on states and in truth on localities and educators to really get the kind of funding that they need out of the already existing budgets. And it's kind of the same thing that we've been seeing with nonprofits. They're being asked to do more with less.
So we have cuts in No Child Left Behind.
There's a nutrition program for low-income women, infants, and children called WIC, Women, Infant, and Children. And that basically provides funding for pregnant women and women who have children with low birth weights and childhood anemia, and that would probably lose about 660,000 women and children across the country because of the cuts proposed by Bush.
They're no longer hungry, or they no longer don't need it? What do you mean they lose them?
Well, the funding would be reduced for the program to the point that they would not have enough money in the program to provide the supports and nutrition supplements for the people in the program. So the only way the program would be able to stay within its budget is to cut people off the rolls. They could do some other kinds of cost-saving measures like administration funding and those sorts of things, but the bulk of it would come from lower number of people on the program.
To the tune of about over 600,000 people?
Mm-hmm.
Women and children?
Yep. It primarily serves low-income women and children, yes.
Okay, what
else? Child care funding would be decreased. Many low-income working families receive child care assistance either through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program, the old welfare program, or through other means.
Because the welfare program was eliminated, people are supposed to, mostly women are now supposed to go to work, and part of that deal was that there was going to be money for them to have child care because they're staying at home because they have to take care of their children.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family program is supposed to have been reauthorized the past 2 years, and Congress has been unable to come to a compromise in order to get it reauthorized.
But they made much ballyhoo about kicking people off of welfare, making them work.
Right.
Well, what about their children?
That's a very important question that's really not getting addressed. The main stumbling block to reauthorization the last 2 years has been that Republicans in Congress want to increase the work requirement up to either 38 or 40 hours, so that if you're receiving cash assistance through the TANF program, you would need to work 38 or 40 hours. The thing that they don't tell you, though, is that they don't want to increase child care funding, so that increase in work hours would be offset by more assistance to have your children in child care.
And we also, even though we're going a little aside from why you're here to talk today,
sure.
But don't we also have to take a look at the money that these women are earning, too, because they can get paid whatever an employer wants them to get paid, can't they?
Sure, that's absolutely correct. A lot of the work that's been done to get folks in TANF into jobs is a negotiation that occurs between the TANF program and the provider. I mean, they're not going to be making below minimum wage, of course, and there are actually some rumblings in Congress this year about increasing the minimum wage, even from Republicans. I should probably also mention that I shouldn't characterize Republicans as a whole. There have been many Republicans in Congress who have been very supportive of increasing child care funding in the TANF program. Most notably, both of the senators from Maine, Senator Snow and Collins.
Now, back to the nonprofit impact here. You've outlined, or you've detailed some of the cuts, some of the programs that are going to be cut within this budget. What is the overall impact on nonprofits? I mean, are we going to see nonprofits not be able to operate since one third of their budget depends upon this governmental money? What's the prognosis?
I don't necessarily think that you'll see kind of a decrease in the ability to operate among nonprofits. There's going to be some, maybe the groups that are more so dependent on state and local grants or federal grants, that will have to cut back on their services. Most others are going to try to shift around their priorities in order to meet the needs of their constituents. One example from the government world is that the Section 8 program, which is low-income housing vouchers, and a way for them to save money is to shift their constituency to higher-income people. The housing voucher program pays 30% the person pays 30% of their income, and then the government picks up the rest for a median, an average housing facility in your area. Now, if you shift it to a higher income person, the 30% is going to be a higher amount, and the voucher is going to cost the government less money, thereby saving the government money. So, but what that does is really impact the very lowest income of the lowest income people. And that may be a shift that happens at some nonprofits. I think that trying to serve more people with less money is never a good option. So there's going to certainly have to be some creative ways to save money and cut back in many nonprofits across the country.
Is it fair to say or to conclude that the budget, the reason why that so many programs are suffering and the reason why the budget is the way that it is because the focus has been changed to it's a war budget. And it's a tax budget.
I would really say a more fair characterization would be that instead of keeping the funding levels for these programs where they are, the Bush administration has moved forward with making tax cuts permanent. Mm-hmm. Just by not continuing to make permanent the tax cuts proposed in 2001-2003, you're going to see huge jumps in revenue for the federal government, and the cuts to these programs are really not going to be necessary. The kind of other thing to keep in mind is that it's not these programs that have caused the large deficits, particularly when President Bush talks about the 150 programs that he's going to cut in order to reduce the deficit. What's really caused the deficit, about 50%, as I said before, has been the tax cuts. So I think that there's two ways to reduce the deficit, and one is by cutting spending, and the other is by increasing revenue. And this budget seeks solely to cut spending and does not consider any increases in revenue.
Proportionately speaking, who would be the larger group of people, the group of people that will suffer or have programs decreased or eliminated as a result of this budget cut, or the people that would have to pay more if the tax cuts were not made permanent?
The tax cuts, if speaking generally, actually cover a huge number of people, because you included in that are the 10% bracket for low-income people, the marriage penalty relief, and a couple of other provisions that have those specific provisions have been focused directly on middle and low income people. So if you look at the tax cuts as kind of from a macro view, the majority by a vast amount of the money that has gone back out of the government from the tax cuts has benefited a very small number of people. And if we're talking about I didn't even get to some of the other programs like food stamps.
I want to talk about those. Can we take a break? Because
sure.
When we come back, I'd like to talk about the cuts in some of the other programs.
Sure.
I'm talking to Adam Hughes, budget policy analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington D.C. to talk about the cuts that occur as a result of the budget proposed by George W. Bush, the impact on your world, your life, nonprofits. We will be back. Stay with us.
You're listening to the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Morning, St. Louis, 31 minutes after the hour, 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by Station Plus. Richardson Road, westbound at 55, look for a disabled vehicle on the shoulder. Eastbound 70 between Grand, there's a disabled vehicle on the left shoulder as well. Westbound 40 between the Clause and the Hanley, look for no problems there. Eastbound 40 between 141 and 270, no problems. Eastbound 70 at Bryan Road and 79 is on the move. Northbound 270 at 44 looks good. Westbound 270 from 367 through 170 is on the move. Northbound 55 from Butler Hill and 270, nothing to report there. Westbound 55, 70 at Poplar Street Bridge is on the move. Northbound Route 3, that ramp onto the PSC looks good. Westbound Kingbridge traffic from the Illinois Bank through the Fleet Landing. Expect normal traffic, and that is a look at this hour's traffic. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by Chaser Plus. Do Chaser hangover pills really work? Yes, Chaser absorbs toxins to help stop hangovers. Take it while you drink so you can wake up feeling great. Buy Chaser at Walgreens, CVS, and GNC. Please drink responsibly, and always remember, don't drink and drive. Now taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and for last day of the year. For today, mostly cloudy, high in the upper 50s. This evening, cloudy chance of showers after midnight with a low in the upper 40s. Saturday, cloudy, breezy chance of showers and thunderstorms throughout the day with a high around the 50-degree mark. And then on Sunday, New Year's Eve, the last day of 2006, mostly cloudy chance of showers with a high in the lower 50s. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have some clear skies. Our current temperature is sitting at 43 degrees. Lambert Field is reporting 43 as well. Stay tuned for more of the best of the wake-up call right here at AM 920 WGNU. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather as well as your news in the top of the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
Recently in St. Louis, some changes were made in healthcare providers, and we at ConnectCare want you to know that sometimes change can be good. ConnectCare, still connected to the community. ConnectCare is now your specialty care clinic hub. If you or your loved one is dealing with kidney disease, you can contact one of ConnectCare's renal specialists at our renal clinic, dedicated to improving the quality of life and providing optimal care for patients with chronic and acute renal disease. At ConnectCare, we have 14 specialty care clinics to serve your healthcare needs. Our specialty care clinic hub includes specialty clinics dealing with arthritis, ENT, GI, orthopedics, and a women's specialty clinic. At ConnectCare, the physicians and staff at our specialty clinics are committed to the philosophy that the best care is provided by those with the greatest commitment to their community. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
Call Akbar Electrical for any of your residential or commercial electrical service needs. Mention this ad for a discount. Akbar, 382-2568, 314-382-2568.
Seasons may come and go, but my allergies are here to stay. That's why I'm Claritin Clear. Claritin relieves my outdoor allergies, and I discovered it relieves my indoor allergies too. Whether it's dust, mold, or even my dog Rex. Claritin clears the way, relieving my worst indoor allergy symptoms. Only non-drowsy Claritin is proven to make me alert and focused so I can think more clearly. Because when I'm alert, I'm at my best. 24-hour non-drowsy Claritin. Live Claritin Clear, indoors and out.
Use as directed. Only brand clinically tested.
This is Sandy.
And this is Bobby.
And we'd like to invite you to join us on The Design Life every Monday afternoon from 4 to 5.
We hope you'll join us as we talk about designing your life to achieve success and fulfillment.
This is Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Join me weekday afternoons from 2 to 4 on AM 920 WGNU. And I look forward to hearing from you. If you have problems with a personal, work, or family relationship, call me at 1-800-DR-LAURA. That's 1-800-DR-LAURA. For the issues that matter most. It's AM 920 WGNU. And for the personal issues that matter most, join me, Dr. Laura, now from 2 to 4 every weekday afternoon. Then go do the right thing.
The struggle for fairness on the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Now we take you back to more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, and I am talking to Adam Hughes, budget policy analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington, D.C. And Adam, before we get to some of the other cuts that are occurring, talk to us about who is OMB Watch.
OMB Watch is a government watchdog group that was founded in the early 1980s. It's been around a little more than 20 years. And our mission really is to promote government openness and citizen participation as the best way to kind of push the main parts of democracy forward. We think that when people are active and involved and they have access to the information about government, and then that's kind of the best result for democracy. There's four main areas. Tax and budget is one of them. We also work on one program specifically about government access to government information and secrecy issues, one program on regulatory role of the federal government, and one on nonprofit speech and nonprofit activism issues.
And because our focus this morning is what impact this has on nonprofits, talk to us about what's the importance of nonprofits?
Nonprofits are extremely important, not only to provide services for people who need help, but also kind of as a main civic a part of our society. A lot of people, whether you're a member of the Sierra Club or AARP or any type of group like that, it's a way that citizens get involved and active in our government and in our society. So they provide a vital role in all aspects of society, I would say.
And in terms of nonprofits and how they deal with this budget and the budgets that are going to be occurring, because this is a 5-year budget.
Mm-hmm.
Nonprofits tend to kind of like look at the world in terms of their singular issue. How do nonprofits battle something like this? Because the Sierra Club's ability to fight for their hunk is going to be different than a local nonprofit, let's say like here in St. Louis, the George Washington Carver House.
Mm-hmm.
But their futures are still tied to this budget. What are they supposed to do? How should they battle this?
That's an excellent question. It's funny that you should mention that, because one of the things that we've been working on here for maybe the last year and a half or so is trying to get more nonprofits involved in a kind of long-range thinking about tax and budget issues, to try to get them out of their individual issue area. We call it the siloed approach, where they're really just concerned about funding, maybe even for just one program.
Mm-hmm.
And try to bring together nonprofits and involve them and engage them in a conversation about how do we work together for a kind of common goal that supports all of our individual silos. Because really, OMB Watch is concerned with having enough revenue in the federal government to meet the priorities of people when they're involved and active in advocating for what they want. So we really see that as kind of one of the main roles of our organization, is to make sure that groups, particularly state and local nonprofits, which have a difficult time working on federal issues, because there's just so many other things that they're working on, and their time is stretched so thin.
Why should a state nonprofit work on a governmental that level?
On the federal level.
On the federal level.
Sometimes it's hard to see, particularly at just a glance, but the impact of the federal budget it washes over everything. Starts at the national level with national programs, but then kind of moves along to state and local issues as well. And sometimes that effect is not felt maybe this year or next year, but a couple years down the road. But it will be felt. The sheer size of the federal government, the funding that goes to really vital services for people, as that role is decreased, the need for state and local groups, government and nonprofits and others to pick up the slack increases. And that puts more of a burden on their kind of regular issues on the state and local level if they don't kind of look out for it before it happens.
Is there an example, something that already exists, of a collaborative effort that you're proposing for the nonprofits to engage in, to advocate on behalf of nonprofits? Is there something that already exists that's like that?
Well, there's a number of nonprofit groups, actually, that advocate on behalf of nonprofits in a way.
Uh-huh.
One is called Independent Sector. That's a group located here in D.C. That's kind of a collection of nonprofits that they keep an eye on, kind of like the program here at OMB Watch on nonprofits. They keep an eye on how nonprofits are able to do their job and changes that go on into federal policy that would affect that. One particular example is the thing that we've been working on since it happened was the audit by the IRS of the NAACP,
right.
Which some believe was undertaken as a retaliation for comments that were made about from the head of the NAACP about President Bush.
And the NAACP said, you know what? No, we're not going to respond to this at all.
I think that's essentially what they did. Yes,
yes.
And there's a lot of issues with the Patriot Act and 9/11 about not only nonprofits but a category of nonprofits, large foundations who give out grants to nonprofits, and kind of what they have to do for quote unquote security reasons about their grantees and where they have to check lists of employees of grantees for security checks and those sorts of things, which I think I don't want to be talking too much about this because this is not really my area, but we don't really want a kind of a Gestapo state where nonprofits and foundations are forced to prove their are not funding terrorist activities. We don't want that to be too intrusive.
Well, can I ask you this, and then we have to take another break,
sure.
And then maybe then we'll be able to come back and talk about the additional programs that are being
cut.
But if these nonprofits got together collectively and began advocating on behalf of all of the issues of nonprofits, would they benefit from, or is... Two questions. Is there a lobbyist out there that advocates for nonprofits, or are they lobbyists that just advocate for the individual organization out there? And wouldn't it be a great thing if they all got together and just had their own lobbyists for nonprofits?
Well, the first question, I think there are both. For groups like Independent Sector and actually another group called Coalition on Human Needs, which is a coalition of other advocacy groups, I think there are some who advocate kind of from a more general nonprofit sense, have a more of a reserved view of what they should be advocating for rather than program specific.
Uh-huh.
The second question, we certainly do think that would be a great thing, and that's one of the goals that we're trying to move forward, I think, with a variety of other groups from across the country with this long-range tax and budget initiative.
And we have to take another break. I'm talking to Adam Hughes, a budget policy analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington, D.C. This is Liz Brown, The Wake Up Call. We'll be back after this break and our Global News Watch. Stay with us.
Stick around for more of the best of The Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Recently in St. Louis, some changes were made in healthcare providers, and we at ConnectCare want you to know that sometimes change can be good. ConnectCare, still connected to the community. ConnectCare is now your specialty care clinic hub. If you or your loved one is dealing with kidney disease, you can contact one of ConnectCare's renal specialists at our renal clinic, dedicated to improving the quality of life and providing optimal care for patients with chronic and acute renal disease. At ConnectCare, we have 14 specialty care clinics to serve your healthcare needs. Our specialty care clinic hub includes specialty clinics dealing with arthritis, ENT, GI, orthopedics, and a women's specialty clinic. At ConnectCare, the physicians and staff at our specialty clinics are committed to the philosophy that the best care is provided by those with the greatest commitment to their community. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
This is your WGNU Global News Update. Dateline London. Britain's Prince Harry apparently will go to Iraq, heading there with his unit in May. London's Daily Telegraph reports the 22-year-old Harry is determined to go, despite reports of resistance from many in the military who believe the third in line to the throne will be a prize target for terrorists. They also believe he would attract attention and put his fellow soldiers in greater jeopardy. Harry would be stationed near the southern port city of Basra. Officials are trying to figure out how to minimize the danger without giving him special treatment. As a second lieutenant, Harry will have command of 11 men and 4 light tanks. Dateline Mexico. Authorities in Mexico say at least 24 people were killed yesterday when a freight train crashed into a bus at a railroad crossing outside Mexico City. Police say the bus driver misjudged the speed of the oncoming 36-car train and tried to cross the track ahead of the lead locomotives. The driver was detained after trying to flee the scene of the accident. The impact crumpled the bus as the train pushed it over 300 feet down the track from the crossing. This is your WGNU Global News Update, sponsored by Reasonable Construction.
Make your holiday exciting by celebrating Christmas New Orleans style.
Come for the food.
Come for the art.
Come for the history.
Come for the sweet sounds of jazz.
Visit NewOrleansOnline.com to plan a December getaway filled with Réveillon feasts, free concerts, French Quarter shopping, and all the excitement of Harrah's Casino. And make it last with discounted hotel rates, courtesy of Papa Noel himself. Visit NewOrleansOnline.com today to get your free guide with more than $2,400 in coupons and jazz up your December New Orleans style.
Come for the fun.
Come feel good.
Come for the beauty. Come for the
spirit, heart, and soul.
Come for it all.
Come fall in love with New Orleans all over again.
Discover Christmas New Orleans style at NewOrleansOnline.com.
Hi, this is Connie Mitchell, co-host of Women Inspiring Women's Authors on the Air. Each Friday, my co-host Liz Tanz and I explore the world of writing and interview local and not-so-local authors. We discuss relevant, timely, and occasionally controversial subjects. So come hear just what it takes to write a book and learn something new along with us. Who knows? You might find a new favorite author. That's Authors on the Air, Fridays from 1 to 2 on AM 920 WGNU.
A voice for those that should be heard. This is the award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now back to more of the best of the Wake-Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Made me want to holler. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. This is the wake-up call. And as a heads-up for the next hour, we are going to have on Bob McChesney. You saw him. He was on Outfoxed. And he's a professor of communications, and we will be talking about the Jeff Gannon story. So you want to stay tuned for that in the next hour. Right now we're talking to Adam Hughes, budget policy analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington, D.C. And Adam, welcome back. Can you, in the last few minutes here that we have, can you talk to us some more about some of the other programs that are going to be cut with this budget?
That I haven't mentioned yet,
yes.
There's a smaller cut is going to be to the low-income housing energy assistance program,
mm-hmm.
which helps low-income people pay for heat and cooling bills in very hot and warm months. There's estimates that will be cut by about 350,000 families. This is a program that has been consistently underfunded. Only about 1 in 5 households who qualify for the program get funding.
Say that one more time, Adam.
Sure. Only about 1 in 5 households who qualify based on their income levels for this program receive funding because the program has not received enough funding.
That's where we started before these cuts.
That's correct.
And when we're talking about qualify, do you happen to know the numbers that you have to have in order to qualify for these programs, just so people can really get a sense of you don't make a whole lot of money?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics for LIHEAP or other programs, but it's really low.
Okay.
I would say most people that are qualified for government assistance programs probably make either slightly more or slightly less than the poverty line, which is about $18,000 a year.
And this is a family. This is not for an
yes.
individual. This
That's
is what
correct.
A family lives on, $18,000 a year. Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In fact, the minimum wage for a full-time worker for a full year makes less than the poverty line at this point and hasn't been the minimum wage. Federal minimum wage hasn't been raised since 1997, so that's one of the reasons for that. What else? The Section 8 program, like I mentioned, would probably lose about 370,000 vouchers across the country. And that, similar to LIHEAP, this is a program that many areas have such long waiting lists that they've closed the waiting list because there's too many people on it. The Head Start program, which I think we mentioned earlier, would probably be cut by about 100,000 kids, varying across states. I had some state-by-state statistics. I can give some numbers for Missouri. If
that would be great.
Folks would be interested. Yeah, LIHEAP would probably impact about 8,900 families in Missouri. The Head Start would be cut by about 2,300 kids in Missouri. Section 8 vouchers, these estimates come, by the way, from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a think tank group here in Washington, D.C. Missouri for Section 8 program housing vouchers would lose about 7,100, their estimates show. So this is kind of, no one has really been spared in this budget.
And not only has no one been spared, but there are some programs that are going to get 100% changes in the amount of cuts.
Oh, sure. I mean, some are being eliminated completely.
Talk to us about the 100% changes, meaning they don't exist anymore.
Exactly, yes. One particular example that the president has tried to cut for the last 3 years is the HOPE 6 program, which is in housing and urban development and works to rehabilitate old public housing facilities. And there's a lot of congressional support for this program, and the president has tried to eliminate it each of the last 3 years. And the funding has increased. Congress has increased its funding each of the last 3 years. So my guess is that will stay in this budget, along with some other cuts such as Amtrak and things that really have a lot of congressional support.
There are programs like universal newborn hearing screenings that will be eliminated in this budget.
Yes, there are many programs that will be eliminated.
Can you give us some more of those programs that are just going to be just done away with?
Yes, I can. Let me pull up my list here. One particular example that it's unclear at this point still exactly how it's going to work is community development funding. The community development block grant and the community services block grant and about 16 other programs that work on community development funding are being consolidated into one program called the Strengthening America's Communities Block Grant, which will be moved over to the Commerce Department. This is kind of another way in which the president's budget is really difficult to follow. There was a lot of press coverage of the fact that these 18 programs had been consolidated, but no list of the programs, and that wasn't released until well after the budget was out. And that funding will decrease, I think, from about $5.6 billion to $3.7 billion, I believe. It's being cut by about a third.
And when you look at these programs that are being just eliminated, these are all programs not all of them, but so many of them have to do with whether or not you're going to be healthy in the rest of your life. I mean, these are fundamental programs that affect children and a lot of rural programs as well.
Oh, that's exactly correct. The community development funding, in fact, a lot of those programs are geared towards providing economic incentives and development in rural communities. So that's a particularly important aspect, and I think one where there would be some large congressional opposition to it. Some other programs that are being eliminated are the Perkins Loan Program, which provides loans to students to go to college. The president is proposing eliminating that.
Just eliminating it. Just absolutely not cutting it, but getting rid of it.
Yes, that's that particular program, yes. There's some, he has provided some slight increases for Pell Grants. You'll probably hear that loans are it's being restructured or shifted, similar to the community development funding.
And does it appear that there is an equal shift, that the program that is being eliminated, that money will be equally applied to the program that is receiving an increase?
No, there's not an even shift, you can't have an even shift and have the ability to have overall non-defense discretionary spending cut.
And how could you have it? Why would you have an even shift? Why not just keep the program? If you're going to do an even across the board shift, why not just keep the programs that exist?
That's a difficult question for me to answer. You'd probably have to ask someone in the Bush administration. My guess is that one of the other things that OMB Watch and I've been working on here is looking into the way in which the government evaluates the effectiveness of programs. The president has been quoted many times as saying this is a budget that focuses on results. And, you know, we're not going to spend your money on programs that aren't getting results. And there's a particular...
Wait a minute, I'm sorry, I just
sure.
have to interject.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this war is getting results?
Well...
I'm sorry. That's not a question to you. I just can't help but say that if that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Sure. Yeah. I would agree. Not to mention the fact that the analysis that we've done of the tool that the Office of Management and Budget uses to evaluate the effectiveness of the programs doesn't really seem to have any logical consistency in the way it's applied to funding requests. Programs that are rated effective are sometimes given decreases, and sometimes programs that are rated ineffective are given increases.
And again, when we're looking at the programs that are just being eliminated, we're talking about healthy communities access programs. We're talking about rural community facilities. We're talking about state planning grant programs, traumatic brain injuries, Medicaid high-risk pool grants. How do you say that these programs are not having any impact? Universal newborn hearing screening, EMS for children. It's breathtaking.
It is, and it's a complicated argument if you get into the discussion about whether programs are showing results. And particularly this tool that the Office of Management Budget uses is called the Program Assessment Rating Tool. The anagram is PART. It's difficult because of the way that this tool is made up, and it's very complex. About the results the program gets are weighed about 50% of the score, but it also takes into consideration, you know, strategic planning by the agency and program,
But that's your tool, right?
No, that's not ours.
That's their tool.
Office of Management and Budget, which is the office of the government that we watch.
There doesn't appear to be any connection between this administration's was using as a reason to eliminate this program.
They say that that's what they've been using.
But it doesn't appear
but
to be.
But the results, if you look at the funding levels and the actual scores of programs that have been reviewed, it's hard to find a consistent pattern.
And I want to thank you very much, Adam Hughes, Budget Policy Analyst for OMB Watch, joining us from Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us here on the Wake Up Call.
Great. Thank you, Liz. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Listen, folks, we're going to be back with Bob.
This is the best Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. More after the top of the hour news, traffic, and weather. This is AM 920.
It is time for us to use our power. Nobody is going to give it to you.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Albinger. You're doing a lot of shoveling today if you live in Denver or across most of the plains. The area is getting socked by another winter storm, the second in about a week. Once again, the Mile High City is getting it especially hard. ABC's August Skamenka is at Denver International Airport.
Daria, with all eyes on travel in and out of Denver and the potential problems it could cause nationwide, so far things are running smoothly. There was little new accumulation here overnight, which allowed snow removal crews to maintain runways and taxi ramps. Four of the airport's six runways are open, and DIA says that's typically what it needs to continue operations in the winter. Daria?
And it's coming on a very busy travel day.
Air traffic controllers are also watching Dallas-Fort Worth. There are thunderstorms in the area, could delay some flights there. And the New York to Florida market expected to be very, very busy today as folks head down for the sun. So folks on those flights could also expect some delays if they're heading down to Florida.
ABC's Lisa Stark at FAA headquarters in Virginia. It won't be long. That's what we're being told about Saddam Hussein's pending execution. ABC's Terry McCarthy's learned what will happen to the former Iraqi leader.
Saddam's arms and legs will be manacled and a hood will be put over his head. The noose will be placed around his neck, and then the executioner will pull the lever that releases the trapdoor under his feet.
Saddam exhausted his final appeal this week. Funeral services will be held today in Palm Desert, California for former President Gerald Ford. First a private prayer service and then a public viewing. ABC's Alex Stone is there.
Security here will be tight. The military is in charge. Members of the public who come to pay their respects will have to park at a country club blocks away. They'll be bussed in. No telling how many people will show up. Organizers are preparing for around 8,000 people, but they say there could be far more.
There's also a private funeral today for James Brown in Augusta, Georgia, with a public service tomorrow for the legendary singer. This is ABC News.
I am a mountain climber. I'm a college student. And I dance when I have a partner.
Being able to devote time to the things I love is every bit as important as taking care of my bone health. And now, with new delicious CitraCal Creamy Bites, I can get the calcium I need to fit my active lifestyle every day. I am Mary McManaman. I am 79, and I am strong.
Tell us about a strong woman you know at StandStrong.com. CitraCal Calcium. Stand strong.
Top three resolutions for the new year. Number three, spend less time at the old refrigerator. Should be easy, because I'm getting a new one. Number two, be happier. Well, a new spa tub should help with that. And number one, spend less money.
Get special deferred financing store-wide with your Home Depot consumer credit card. And get up to a $250 gift card by mail-in rebate with purchase of major appliances over $297. The Home Depot. You can do it. We can help. Rebate offer valid through January 15th in U.S. only. See store for details.
Mike Tyson's in trouble with the law again. This time the former heavyweight champ was arrested on drunken driving charges after he left a nightclub in Scottsdale, Arizona. There's not much that can make the British Postal Service uneasy, except maybe a boy wizard. Here's ABC's Deirdre Bryant.
The launch date for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows has not yet been announced, but it's already the top-selling book on Amazon's British website. Hundreds of thousands of fans are expected to order the book before publication. The British Royal Mail is already conferring with retailers and renting hundreds of extra trucks for deliveries. Last year, one in every 50 British households ordered a copy of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Deirdre Bryant, ABC News.
Smile, you're on candid camera, but it's no joke. On school buses in Manchester, New Hampshire, the superintendent apparently had enough complaints from drivers of badly behaving students that he's ordered the district to install video cameras on each bus. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Brandmeier with your WGNU News Update for the 8 o'clock hour. In the news this Friday, reported rape cases in the city of St. Louis are up 20% over last year, according to FBI statistics. Kathleen Hanrahan with the YWCA says it's vital that sexual assault victims come forward.
When a woman or a man is sexually assaulted and they receive an appropriate effective response, they are far more likely to move forward in their recovery process immediately after the assault.
The YWCA, along with the police and women support groups, are training police in better practices when dealing with rape victims. The groups are also entering select schools in the city to talk with middle school boys about respecting women and avoiding sexual assaults. St. Louis public school teachers will join elected officials, parents, administrators, and citizens today to call for a public hearing on the district's future. The group wants a hearing in St. Louis before the State Board of Education decides whether to act on the recommendations of a special advisory panel. The committee, led by former Washington University Chancellor William Danforth and civil rights attorney Frankie Freeman, has advised putting a three-person transitional board in place at the troubled district. Metro will operate a special shuttle to help people get to the first night celebration on New Year's Eve. Diane Williams, a spokesperson for Metro, says people can take Metrolink to the Grand Metrolink station and then hop on the bus for only $1. Williams says Metrobus and Metrolink will be operating on a normal Sunday schedule on New Year's Eve, but there will be some late departure trains for New Year's Eve partygoers. For more information, log on to www.metrostlewis.org. Finally this hour, the 7-8 Rams are hoping to squeeze into the playoffs this weekend. Scott Linehan's team will head to Minnesota on Sunday for a must-win game against the Vikings. The Rams need a victory combined with losses or ties by the Panthers, Falcons, and Giants this weekend in order to reach the postseason. Rams fullback Paul Smith remains doubtful with a neck injury, while defensive end Victor Adeyanju has been downgraded to questionable because of an injury to his forearm. It's a noon kickoff on Sunday at the Metrodome. This WGNU News Report is brought to you by RAD and the American Federation of Musicians. Season's greetings from RAD and the American Federation of Musicians. Remember, music lives and you should too. So buckle up and use a designated driver. Learn more at RADD.org. That's your look at local news for the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeier for Radio Free St. Louis. Good morning, St. Louis. 7 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by Open from American Express. Eastbound 70 at Grand, that incident's been cleared. Earlier stalled vehicle has been removed from that shoulder. Northbound 55 at Butler Hill, there's an accident. Right lane's blocked. Westbound 44 at Lewis, there's a disabled vehicle reported. Westbound 40 at McCausland and Hanley, look for no delays. Eastbound 40 between 141 and 270, look for no problems there. Eastbound 70 at Bryan Road and 79 is on the move. Northbound 270 at 44, look for no problems there. Westbound 44 between, or westbound 270 between 367 and 170 is looking good. Westbound Kingbridge traffic is rolling well into downtown, and westbound Poplar Street Bridge traffic looks good rolling into downtown. Highway N at Drake, there's a report of an accident, and that is a look at this hour's traffic. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by Open from American Express. Open, how American Express serves small business. To learn more, visit open.com or call 1-800-NOW-OPEN. Now, taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and the last day of the year, Sunday. For today, mostly cloudy, high in the upper 50s. This evening, chance of showers after midnight, cloudy, and a low in the upper 40s. Saturday, breezy, chance of showers and thunderstorms are possible, high in the mid-50s. And Sunday, mostly cloudy with another chance of showers, a high in the mid-50s. Currently, we have 43 degrees and partly cloudy skies. Lambert Field is reporting 40 degrees. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown, the best of Liz Brown, and the wake-up call that's up next. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world and how they affect us. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Mondays at 9. And this week, we are taking a look at a story that is going to be very interesting to see what kind of legs this story sprouts, what kind of impact this story has. This is a story about a man whose name is Jeff Gannon, and how Jeff Gannon managed to use an alias to get a press pass and have daily access to the White House. And I think the story probably involves a little bit more, because the answers to those questions raise other questions about how the White House is giving access. This is Liz Brown. This is Mondays at 9. To help us with this conversation about Jeff Gannon, I have Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism joining us from Austin, Texas. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
How are you?
Doing fine here in Texas.
Very good. Jeff Gannon.
Oh?
Jeff Gannon.
Yes. Excuse me. My computer just came alive there, but it's been quieted.
Okay, Jeff Gannon, why should we be concerned about this story?
Well, I think there's actually two very different and very interesting aspects to this story about Jeff Gannon, or Jeff Guckert, as his name might more accurately be. The first, of course, is the obvious, that the White House allowed someone who's not really a journalist but was working for a website run by a pro-Republican group, allowed him entrance into the briefing and presidential press conferences, which is, you know, access that many people would like. And, of course, while there, he was not quizzing the president on possible problems in the administration or asking tough questions. He was throwing softball questions out that allowed the president to make his points. And, in fact, the questions themselves often were denigrating to the opposition party. So the clear problem of the White House presenting or allowing someone to present himself as a journalist, who in some sense really isn't, for propaganda purposes, is obviously a problem. But I think it raises another issue, which is, who really is a journalist in this culture? That's an interesting question. It's always been an interesting question. We're seeing it play out not only in this White House story, but in the attempts to force reporters to testify about confidential sources. That also raises the question of who is a journalist, and if journalists have some protection, who might those journalists be? And I think the mainstream media, of course, wants to keep a lock on that and to define journalists as those people who work in mainstream media outlets. But, of course, there's lots of other journalism in the world. So there's several different aspects of this case that I find very interesting.
Well, and shouldn't we, going back to the question of how Guckert, or how James Guckert or Jeff Gannon got received access to the White House, shouldn't we be very concerned about how someone with fake credentials, journalist or not, but fake credentials, how do you get daily access to the White House? And as a professor of journalism, surely you would be able to tell us that it's not luck of the draw that the President of the United States calls on you to ask a question at a press conference.
Of course not, and I think that's a good point. We should set this in a broader context of the way in which all presidents, and in fact political actors in general, try to control to the degree they can the way they are framed in the news. That's not new to the Bush administration. What is new, I think, is the Bush administration does it with a vengeance. I've never seen an administration in the last 20 years that had the skill and the kind of ruthlessness that the Bush administration does about controlling the press. This is, I think, taking it to a new level where you pepper the audience in a press conference with essentially what are plans. I think we should all be concerned about this because, of course, it's not just of interest to journalists. The whole notion of the role of journalism in a democracy is that journalism is a check on power, a check from outside the governmental structures. Journalism is supposed to be independent. But the Bush administration would very much like to tame that independence. And quite frankly, I don't think the press is independent enough or critical enough, especially since 9/11. But what little independence there is, the Bush administration would very much like to squeeze out. And that's what this is. This story is part of that bigger story about the way in which political operatives, and I think especially the Republican political operatives, are really trying to do that. They're trying to destroy journalism in the sense of journalism as an independent check on their power.
Well, aren't they kind of having it both ways, too? Because on the one hand, you can just dismiss Jeff Gannon as a non-journalist. And then on the other hand, you want to hold other people up to journalistic standards. So they're kind of like having it at both ways. They want Dan Rather to operate a certain way, but Jeff Gannon they can dismiss.
Yes, although I don't think they really want Dan Rather to operate as an independent journalist. What they want, of course, is to curb the more independent tendencies of journalists. So you're absolutely right. The White House is playing both sides of the street on this. It's really contending something that I think has never been supported by the evidence, which is that somehow the press is out to get conservative politicians. I've never seen a president that's gotten quite the free ride that the Bush White House has gotten, quite frankly.
Do you see other journalism institutions, other newspapers, really grabbing a hold of this Jeff Gannon story? And if they don't, why wouldn't they?
Well, it has been covered, and in places like the Washington Post,
right.
I think covered fairly extensively. And journalists have a stake in this because, in a sense, it makes them look good. So they've been willing to press this story a bit. But they also, as I said earlier, don't want to press an underlying issue, which is who gets to call himself or herself a journalist in the world. You know, we don't have a system of press licensing in this country. We take the First Amendment's guarantees of free speech and free press to mean that the government can't get involved in licensing journalists the way they license other professionals, like doctors or lawyers. First Amendment freedoms preclude that. But that does raise this question, who gets to call themselves journalists? Because, of course, if you can claim to be a journalist, you can claim to be operating in the public interest. And that's a powerful sort of status to claim in the world. So I think journalists, mainstream journalists, are also kind of nervous about this because who is and who isn't a journalist is hardly a settled issue in this culture.
Well, was Jeff Gannon a journalist?
I think in this case, he was not. He was a political operative.
And why? How do you distinguish between him being a journalist and a political operative?
Well, I think that the fundamental criteria for being a journalist is independence, real independence from any center of power that can control you. Now, this raises very interesting questions, because if the hallmark of journalism is independence, then we have to look at corporate, commercial, mainstream journalism and ask the same question.
How could they
How
be?
Independent are they?
Well, how could they be?
Well, of course, they don't work in a vacuum. They work in an institution that has interests, and there are lots of stories about what happens inside newsrooms when journalists pursue stories that are not to the liking of the people who own and run the system. So I think, you know, this is part of the swamp we walk into if we start asking the question, who is a journalist? Because if a journalist is someone who has the independence to be critical, you know, the old notion behind journalism of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. Well, what if the comfortable that you might want to afflict are best friends with the owner of your paper? What if, in fact, your newspaper or broadcast station itself is part of a larger corporate structure? Does that corporate structure want to be afflicted? They're the comfortable, after all. You know, all of these questions that are so central to the practice of contemporary journalism start tumbling out. And I think what mainstream journalists want to do is condemn someone like Jeff Gannon / James Guckert, but kind of leave it at that and not get into these other issues, because I think it undermines, in some sense, the claims that mainstream journalists make themselves.
Is there a difference between being independent and being partisan? Can you be both?
I think you can. I think the model for a journalist is someone who is partisan for the interpretation of the world that he or she has come to hold. Let me give you an example, a real-life example, because I just heard him speak. I have a friend who's a journalist in India. His name is Sainath. He's one of the great journalists in the world. He's not partisan in the sense he does not take up a position for or against any political party in India. He doesn't pursue policy proposals and support them. What he does is go out into the world and be critical of all sides. Now, in the course of doing that over the last 25 years, he's developed positions. He has a point of view. He has a way to understand the world, and he doesn't shy away from that. he's willing to go out and defend his point of view. He doesn't mind writing from a point of view that is clearly political in the sense of political commitment. But he doesn't yoke himself to any institution, any party, any particular plan. And I think that's the role of journalists, to be honest about the conclusions they've reached in the world. Because after all, if you send journalists into the world for 20 years, you'd want them to develop some opinions, wouldn't you? You'd want them to develop some analysis. Otherwise, are they just bumping around aimlessly in the world? No, of course you want them to be able to articulate that analysis. But I hope and think it's best when journalists can do that independent of specific political parties, for instance.
So in this modern day of brand new, and I'm going to use the word journalistic entities popping up, bloggers, for example, would you consider a blogger a journalist? And could a blogger be an independent journalist?
Yes, I think sometimes they can, but I don't think all bloggers qualify as journalists. In addition to independence, I think journalism, we should think of it if not as a profession, as a craft. And there are, just like if you're a carpenter or a plumber, in any craft there are skills you learn. For journalists, those central skills are how to evaluate the credibility of information, whether they come from documents or interviews with people. What we want journalists to be able to do is to critically examine the evidence that they collect. Now, a lot of bloggers, I don't think, really do that. I think a lot of bloggers simply pontificate. They pass along information that is supportive of their political position, but a lot of the bloggers I read are not doing journalism in the sense of stepping back and trying to provide an evaluation of information. Now, some bloggers do that, and some have, in fact, become very well known for their reporting. Sometimes they do it with a political bent, but I think, you know, in the end, those are the two things we need from journalism, that independence and that skill, that attention to the craft of going out into a very complex world and trying to understand it in ways that ordinary people can't. Let's say, take again my friend Sinoff from India. He is expert at going into the government reports and extracting data and analysis that others are just not trained to do. And so it's not simply a question of, you know, spouting off about what's on your mind. That in and of itself, from my point of view, doesn't make you a journalist. What makes you a journalist is attention to the craft and a commitment to that independence.
So, Robert, who should decide on whether or not an individual or an entity or a blogger is in fact a journalist? And the second part to that question is how do those that are not in that world figure out who is a journalist and who's not?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think everyone who wants to be a journalist in the United States should make an application to me. And then I'll... No, okay, so well, maybe that won't work so well.
All right, then let me decide.
Yeah, you know what? You trust me, don't you, Liz?
Yes, I do.
Come on. No, I think, you know, that gets... Again, if you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, there are state laws.
Right.
There's a bar association, there's a medical association. They have a credentialing process. But we don't want to apply that journalism.
Well, there's also a credentialing process, and also there's a part of the, within the legal world,
sure.
If you do something wrong, you take, if a lawyer does something wrong, you take that grievance to that entity, and that entity checks that attorney for doing something wrong. We don't have that in journalism.
Absolutely. It doesn't always work very well in the lawyering world.
Well, true fact, it doesn't, but in theory it's there. It's there.
Absolutely, and that's another important point. There's no way the government can issue licenses for journalism, and there's no mechanism for disciplining journalists. That means, in a sense, journalism has no definition that anyone is ever going to agree upon across the board. Journalism, remember, historically, journalism has also changed a lot. At one point in the United States, most journalists, as we would use the term, were openly affiliated with political parties or even specific politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Often their newspapers were subsidized. In that kind of world, people read widely. They read many papers. They knew that journalists were attached to politicians, and they could filter that out. In today's world, it's in some sense much messier because you have mainstream journalists who hold themselves out as neutral and independent and objective. You have others who call themselves journalists who are much more overtly partisan.
In a way,
it's kind of a big mess right now, and I think there's no way for any centralized authority to determine who is and isn't a journalist. I certainly wouldn't want journalism schools doing it. I wouldn't want the government doing it, and I don't even want journalists themselves doing it. I think one of the things we have to be careful of is any time that the political activities, and in some sense journalism is always a political activity, it's always trying to make sense of a world of power, and that's politics. So I'm always very hesitant to ever limit the way in which people can go forward to engage in political activity.
So how do those that are not journalists decide? I mean, what advice do you give to people to determine whether or not what they're looking at, because there are people that now have, and millions of people now have access to the Internet, and they're going to be reading all kinds of things, and they call my show all the time with questions about how do I filter this out, how do I determine what should I look for in determining whether or not what I'm reading is actual journalism, as opposed to...
That's a great question, and it's a question I get every time I speak in public about politics and the media. And the answer is, unfortunately, it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, because I don't think you can any longer go to one or two sources and feel like you have the truth. In fact, I don't think that it was ever possible.
No.
So how do you do it? Well, I do it by reading widely, by trying to compare the stories. I especially like to read the foreign press and look at how there are differences often between the foreign press and the U.S.-based press, and then I can make judgments about which reporters I trust. So sometimes I go looking for the work of specific journalists because I have developed, in a sense, a trust for them over time. It doesn't mean I believe everything they say as if it were the gospel truth, but, you know, if you think about it, I work in a university. Let's say you wanted to find out, you know, what were the causes of World War I? Take a fairly standard question historians ask. Would you go to one historian and take his or her answer as the definitive answer? No, it's a complex world. The causes of any war are complex. There are many different approaches, and you would try to read widely and read different approaches that different historians have taken. And unfortunately, to be a citizen at this moment in U.S. history requires a lot of work.
Yes, it does.
The governmental forces have concentrated a lot of power. They do a very good job of manipulation and propaganda. And to be a citizen, I hear this from people all the time, exactly what you said. People are kind of reeling. How do I know what to believe? Well, here I think it's always good to remember the words of one of the great journalists of U.S. history, the late I.F. Stone. Many people may know I.F. Stone had a political newsletter that he ran himself, and he was legendary for his ability to pierce through the propaganda of the government. And his first rule for journalists was to remember one thing: governments lie. All governments lie. That's the first rule of journalism for I.F. Stone. Of course, it doesn't mean that everything that governments say is a lie every time, but it does remind us that power does lead people to attempt to manipulate public opinion. And that's true not only of the Bush administration or of U.S. politics. Unfortunately, it's true across the board of concentrated power.
But
so,
don't you also have to have a society that is willing to or even considers it necessary to question authority?
Well, that's an interesting point, because I think the United States is has a kind of a split personality on this. On the one hand...
And wait a minute, I'm going to have to... Sure. We have to take a break on that. When we come back, we will be talking more with Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism, joining us from Austin, Texas. We have much, much, much to talk about, folks. Stay with us as we continue with Mondays at 9.
You're listening to the best of the wake-up call. Stick around for more following the traffic and the weather and these local commercials. St. Louis, 31 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by Open from American Express. Westbound 44 at Lewis, there's a disabled vehicle on the right shoulder on that ramp. Eastbound 70 to Bermuda, that north ramp, There's a disabled vehicle reported there. Westbound 40 at McCausland and Hanley, expect normal traffic. Eastbound 40 between 141 and 270 looks good. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79, look for no delays. Northbound 270 at 44 is on the move. Westbound 270 at 367. And 170 is on the move. Westbound 5570 on the Poplar Street Bridge is rolling well. Westbound Kingbridge traffic looks good. And northbound Route 3, that is no delays on that ramp. That is a look at this hour's traffic. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by Open from American Express. Open, how American Express serves small business. To learn more, visit open.com or call 1-800-NOW-OPEN. Now, taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and Sunday, the last day of 2006. For today, mostly cloudy, high in the upper 50s this evening. Cloudy, chance of showers after midnight, low in the upper 40s. For Saturday, cloudy, breezy, chance of showers and thunderstorms throughout the day with a high in the 50s. And Saturday, or on Sunday, the last day of the year, mostly cloudy, chance of showers with a high in the lower 50s. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have partly cloudy skies, 42 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 42 as well. Stay tuned for more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 9 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
This is Decent Guy Don, the original conspiracy hunter. You know, the guy that keeps you up to date on all the good guys and the bad guys out of the Council of Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati crowd, and assorted other characters who are squeezing the life out of our great American country. Tune in every evening to hear the thunderous crash as I pull the linchpin from the foundations of the House of the New World Order as it crashes down at 7 p.m. Monday through Friday with the conspiracy hunter right here at WGNU 920 a.m.
Call Akbar Electrical for any of your residential or commercial electrical service needs. Mention this ad for a discount. Akbar, 382-2568, 314-382-2568.
Another flu season is rapidly approaching. Are you and your family prepared? Visiting Nurse Association of St. Louis has these critical tips to keep the flu out of your home. Get vaccinated against influenza whenever the vaccine becomes available. Always wash your hands vigorously with soap and hot water. Regularly disinfect kitchen, bathroom, and other household surfaces where germs and bacteria thrive. For more info, visit VNASTL.com. This message is brought to you by the Visiting Nurse Associations of America, your local visiting nurses, and Radio Free St. Louis.
This is Mitch Washington of the St. Louis office of Edward Jones, located at 200 North Broadway downtown, inviting you to tune in to Radio Free St. Louis for the WGNU Stock Market Recap, weekday afternoons immediately following the 3:30 traffic update. Find out how your investments are doing and how the numbers on Wall Street are affecting you. That's the WGNU Stock Market Recap with me, Mitch Washington, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio Free St. Louis, AM 920 WGNU.
Connect Care, still connected to the community. Sometimes it seems like things are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up and hard to keep track. At Connect Care, we want you to know that yes, there have been some changes, and yes, we are still connected to the community. At Connect Care, we still have a retail pharmacy open 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. At Connect Care, we still provide transportation to patients that qualify. At Connect Care, we still provide access to in-house laboratory services. At Connect Care, we still provide some of the region's best board-certified doctors. At Connect Care, we still provide urgent care. And at Connect Care, we still see patients on a sliding fee scale. Yes, changes have been made at Connect Care, but we're still connected to you. Connect Care, still connected to the community.
The struggle for fairness on the award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now back to more of the best of the Wake-Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
You can't put it on another day. I don't care what others say. They think we don't listen anyway. The time has come today.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back to Mondays at 9. We're talking to Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism, and he's joining us from Austin, Texas, and where we are talking about the story that broke a couple weeks ago, about a Jeff Gannon, a former, I don't even want to call him a reporter, but a person that was caught without credentials reporting in a very partisan way and having access to the White House with credentials that were based upon a false name. Welcome back, Robert.
Great to be with you, Liz.
And on our way out, we were talking about speaking true or questioning authority.
Right.
Continue.
Well, I thought it's kind of an odd sort of split in this country. On the one hand, we talk about our great heritage of freedom and how we broke away from the British and how sort of almost the quintessential American spirit is an individualism that questions authority. And we hear that over and over again. And at the same time, especially after 9/11, we have a kind of hyper-patriotism in which people are encouraged to never question authority. It's a sort of split in the American psyche, I think. And I think, you know, when people do criticize authority, especially in times of war, they're often accused of being unpatriotic. I think it's one of the odder parts of U.S. politics right now. And I think when you talk to people from around the world, as I often do, they're often asking the question, how come, you know, for a country that's supposed to be rooted in a revolutionary ideal, how come you people seem to essentially accept the pronouncements of the powerful so often? I think that's an important question for politics in the U.S. today.
Well, as a professor of journalism, have you seen in the last, or have you observed in the last couple of decades or so, that there really just seems to be a spirit within this country, and this is well before 9/11, that we don't question authority, or that there's no reason to question authority, and there's no value in it, from our high schools, students having to succumb to all kinds of things that they don't have to succumb to as an adult, for instance, having their lockers examined without a search warrant. They're not allowed to print in their papers what I was allowed to print in my papers when I was in high school. Haven't we been creating the type of society that now that 9/11 has occurred, we'd already been pre-prepared to not really question or challenge authority?
I couldn't agree more. As someone who teaches in a university, I'm always struck by the kind of contradiction. We talk about how important it is to teach critical thinking. It's a buzzword in education these days. But if you look at how our school system actually operates, sometimes it teaches anything but critical thinking. Just look at the press, I would call it an insane obsession with standardized testing right now to evaluate students. That has nothing to do with critical thinking. It has to do with teaching students how to take information in and spit it back in very, very narrow ways on an exam. Is that training in critical thinking? No, it's the antithesis. In fact, much of our school system, many people have pointed this out over the years, is really training to endure boredom. You sit in rows, you listen to the teacher, you do what you're told. I'm not condemning education or teachers. I think most people in education work very, very hard, but they work in a system that, again, has these contradictory trends in it, I think. And especially when the United States, or in some sense any country, goes to war, you see this play out so dramatically that somehow in times of war we're told we have to suspend our ability to think critically, suspend democratic processes, give up rights, allow ourselves to essentially be subjected to very arbitrary authority. Now, what's driving that at the moment, I think, is mostly fear. And this is a very fear-driven country, I think, at this point in history. And I'm personally very, very worried about that, because I think when people are motivated mostly by fear, they are far too willing to give up that power. And I don't just mean personal autonomy. I mean the collective power that has moved all of the great movements in our history, the civil rights movement, the labor movement. They were, I think, driven by a kind of critical thinking and a connection that people developed to try and make the world a better place, which inevitably put them in conflict with centralized authority.
Well, and Robert, I see that within the community of African descent when I look at where we have come since the signs have come down. And it seems to me that, there was a period of time between the 60s and the 80s and the 80s and the 2000s that people felt comfortable, or at least thought that they were comfortable, and began to kind of just not move away or even criticize the idea of having to confront and to fight for anything anymore.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I was just thinking of two things. One is Malcolm X, who, of course, we just, I was going to say celebrated, although you don't celebrate the anniversary of an assassination.
Right.
I was listening to some old speeches of his, and at one point he says, how many of you are really, he was talking to a black audience at that point, 1963, I believe, how many of you are really willing to do, he said, what it takes to challenge power, to take that risk? And I think that's a question we always have to ask ourselves. As you point out, affluence is one of the most, I think, debilitating factors in politics. The more affluent people are, the more they tend to be willing to turn away from politics. And that's a serious problem at this point, I think, in the United States. However, you know, I was also thinking, as we're talking, of a great journalist from the African American community, Glenn Ford, who's done radio. He's
he
done
was
television.
On my show just last week.
Oh, Glenn, you know.
Oh, he's wonderful.
BlackCommentator.com.
Oh, it's so awesome.
Is pound for pound, I think, one of the best websites out there on politics. And again, Glenn's a journalist, I think. Glenn, he has a political perspective.
I love him.
He's not
wonderful.
Shy about it. He's working, and what made me think of it is we had Glenn down here to speak last fall. It was a great event. And he's now working on a book about these issues and about where black politics has gone. And he's someone who's been, you know, down in the trenches ever since the early 1970s, mainly working through media, but a really, I think, really sharp analyst of these things. And Glenn has made some of these same observations have a lot of people. I think the really the question you're getting at, and it's interesting the way you're phrasing it, because some of the things you're talking about in the black community are true across the board.
Absolutely.
And the question is, do we really want to live in a democracy? And by democracy, I don't just mean a society where you get to vote every 2 or 4 years. I mean a society in which people take an active role in the formation of public policy.
And I saw we have to take a break, but I saw a poll that came out, and it was so troubling. A poll of high school students. And the result of the poll said that the majority of the students polled felt that the First Amendment went too far.
I saw that too. That was put a chill up your spine.
It did. It absolutely did. We're going to take a break. I'm talking to Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism, joining us from Austin, Texas. My name is Liz Brown. This is Mondays at 9. We'll be back. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Best of the Wake Up Call. Stick around for more following these messages.
Looking for time made just for you? Wanting to hear from some young people who are cool and well-informed? Have some questions adults just can't seem to answer? There is a place for you on WGNU Radio. Tune in Sunday nights at 5:30. You'll hear teens talk about stuff teens understand. Find out about the latest in music, sports, and other issues that matter. Finally, a talk show for teens, about teens, by teens on 9:20 a.m. 5:30 Sunday nights. Sponsored by the St. Charles Lwanga Center.
Recently in St. Louis, some changes were made in healthcare providers, and we at ConnectCare want you to know that sometimes change can be good. ConnectCare, still connected to the community. ConnectCare is now your specialty care clinic hub. If you or your loved one is dealing with kidney disease, you can contact one of ConnectCare's renal specialists at our renal clinic, dedicated to improving the quality of life and providing optimal care for patients with chronic and acute renal disease. At ConnectCare, we have 14 specialty care clinics to serve your healthcare needs. Our specialty care clinic hub includes specialty clinics dealing with arthritis, ENT, GI, orthopedics, and a women's specialty clinic. At ConnectCare, the physicians and staff at our specialty clinics are committed to the philosophy that the best care is provided by those with the greatest commitment to their community. ConnectCare, still connected to the community.
This is your WGNU Global News Update.
Dateline Zurich. The UN Human Rights Chief is asking Iraqi authorities to hold off on carrying out Saddam Hussein's death sentence. Louise Arbour said there are concerns about the fairness of the original trial. Arbour added the appeal judgment is a lengthy and complex decision that requires careful study. She claims there are a number of concerns about the fairness of Saddam's trial, and there should be assurances that these issues be comprehensively addressed. She added that Iraq and the international community have an interest in making sure the sentence is imposed only after a trial and appeal are considered credible and impartial. Arbour also said that under the agreement signed by the Iraqi government, Saddam has the right to ask for a pardon or commutation from the, quote, appropriate authorities. Dateline Tokyo. Leaders in Japan will seek next month to extend a law that will allow their military to provide humanitarian and reconstruction aid in Iraq beyond next July. That's according to media reports, which say Parliament will take up the issue when it meets next month. Japan currently has some 200 Air Force personnel based in Kuwait. A law enabling Japanese troops to help transport supplies to the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq is set to expire on July 31st. Japan sent around 600 ground troops to southern Iraq in 2004 for reconstruction and humanitarian aid, but the last of those soldiers returned home in July. This is your WGNU Global News Update, sponsored by Reasonable Construction.
Hello, this is Brother Willie Loudon. Join me every Sunday morning at 8:30 and Let's Praise Him broadcast. Good gospel music and the latest church news to help you start your Sunday morning. So tune in on the Let's Praise Him broadcast every Sunday morning at 8:30 right here on WGNU.
This is Mark Hinderleiter, host of Lessons in Leadership. Whether you're an executive, manager, teacher, volunteer leader, or head of a family, this show is for you. You'll get practical tips from real leaders on topics that matter to you. Tune in every Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock to Lessons in Leadership.
It's the information you need to know about but can't find anywhere else on the dial. The award-winning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now more of the best of the Wake-Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Son, what you don't understand, my words might never explain. So I am hoping that time...
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back to Mondays at 9. Our guest this morning is Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism, joining us from Austin, Texas. And welcome back, Robert.
Great to be with you again, Liz.
So we started this conversation off talking about Jeff Gannon or James Guckert. What does this say? What does the fact that this person was able to make it into the White House with these faked credentials and lob these softball questions to George W. Bush, does it say something about the state of affairs for journalism? And does it kind of like maybe even feed people's cynicism about journalism and cause them to not even believe anything that they see in the paper anymore?
Well, I think that process is going forward and has been going for some time, that people's trust in and credibility of journalists has been dropping. I think we should remember that in a sense, the Guckert / Gannon scandal is not the making of journalism. It's not journalism's fault, in a sense. I think journalism has lots of problems, and it needs to confront those problems. There are problems of concentrated ownership, there are problems of a kind of disconnection between journalism and quite frankly, ordinary people. A friend of mine talks about the difference between mass media and mass reality. That is, many people see represented in the media something that doesn't really fit their own lives, and that's a problem for journalism. I think all of these things come together to form, I think, a crisis in journalism. But to me, we always have to think about journalism not in some sort of vacuum. It's not only a crisis in journalism, it's a crisis in democracy. When journalism is failing, it also means that democracy is failing. And we you know, to go back to some of our earlier points, we live in a world in which the administration openly engages in media manipulation and propaganda in ways that were really never acceptable before, even if people tried to get away with it. So we see the administration paying journalists to promote their policies
in the public as apparently independent journalists. We see the administration creating video news releases to distribute to local television news stations to promote their policies, which violates the law that says the U.S. government can't propagandize its own people.
Or the letters that are coming out from about Social Security.
Yes. It's a really a phenomenal attempt to control the public mind.
Well, it's also, and one of the things that I think that this particular administration has been very effective at is they've waged war on every single front. So it's overwhelming to all of us out here about, so which fight do you want to focus on today?
And also, not only waging war on every front, but doing it in a way that doesn't try to beat the opposition, but tries to destroy the opposition. I'm down here in Texas, where we live with the effects of Tom DeLay's attempt to really destroy the Democratic Party. And I want to make it clear, I'm personally not a Democrat. I'm an independent political person with left leanings. But I don't feel any great allegiance to the Democratic Party. But it is striking how the Bush administration and this kind of radical reactionary Republican gang doesn't just want to win. They want to destroy. They want to control the entire judiciary. They want to control all the facets of public power. And, of course, the corporate world is to a large degree already on their side. We're looking at a concentration of power that isn't fascist in traditional terms. I always object when people say, Bush is a fascist. It's not. It's a different kind of system, but it's a concentration of power that in some ways is every bit as dangerous as fascism, that can allow people to be, you know, fundamentally disconnected from a democratic process.
Well, and the corporate strategy and the corporate mentality is like that as well. I mean, it is to annihilate the competition. And it is to stand alone.
Yeah.
As the only.
And nowhere is that more striking, that philosophy is, than in the Bush administration foreign policy, which really is trying to make that theory work in the world. And of course, I think you and I might agree, Liz, the problem is, no matter what you think of that, it can't work in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crazy project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I've never been a big fan of the people who run the world out of Washington, D.C., but there's a kind of fanaticism in this administration that I find very dangerous because it's not reality-based. So if they think they can invade Iran because they don't like what Iran's doing in politics, even though an invasion of Iran would be absolutely insane, for a long time I thought there's no way these people would try to pull that off. But now I look around and I see...
Oh, it's happening.
And I think, okay, well...
It's happening.
You know, maybe I'm just underestimating their capacity to, in a sense, blind themselves to the realities of the world. Now, that's where democracy comes in. The only thing that can really constrain that kind of behavior is a democratic population that refuses to accept it.
So we have about 3 minutes left here. So here's my question to that observation of yours. Are we prepared to do that kind of battle?
So,
are the citizens in this country at this time prepared to do the type of battle against everything that you've described?
Well, quite frankly, I think no, not at this moment. And when I think about my own political work, I do a lot of local organizing. I try to be realistic. I think the question isn't what to do with the movement right now. The question is, how do we build a movement? And by a movement, I mean progressive politics in general, people who care about justice and international law abroad, people who care about working folks, people who care about the just cruel and ongoing effects of racism and sexism. I think that progressive project is, to say the least, in the hole right now. And there's a lot of work to build that movement. A lot of the work I do in local organizing is just to create space for people to come together and reclaim that politics. And I think it's a long struggle. But, you know, every struggle that ever made progress in this world was a long struggle. And I think we have to have realistic expectations and make commitments realizing that there will be risks. But every progressive movement that ever was successful was led by people who were willing to take risks.
And people that picked a battle and weren't overwhelmed by all of the battles that needed to be fought.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, I always use the example of the civil rights movement at the end of the 19th or the early 20th centuries. Legal segregation had been upheld by the Supreme Court. Lynchings were on the rise. Slavery had essentially been reenacted through convict leasing out of the prisons. I mean, it was a pretty grim time. Those people did not give up. Ida B. Wells did not say, oh, woe is me, the world is awful, I might as
it's
well.
It's too hard. It's too hard.
You know, I'll just go watch cable TV. Now, admittedly, Ida B. Wells didn't have the distraction of cable TV, but, you know, these are the historical figures we have to look at that endured over time. These aren't people who just emerged one day and made a great speech. You know, Martin Luther King wasn't, you know, the civil rights movement himself, and his own, you know, commitment to it was longstanding. That's the kind of model we need that understands movements as not just leaders, but also the people who make those leaders possible.
Professor Robert Jensen of the University of Texas School of Journalism, thank you so much for joining us here on the Wake Up Call.
It's always great to talk, Liz.
Pleasure. Listen, folks, my name is Liz Brown. I'll be back same
Stick
time, same place
for more
tomorrow.
Of the best of the Stay Wake strong. Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air from the brother.
It is time for us to use our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Very sad news for all of you and people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, talk to me, sister.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
Struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
The latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Albinger, and that is a cold wind that's blowing across the plains this morning from another winter storm. Once again, Denver is getting the brunt of it. Driving is tough, if not impossible. This man just left his car.
I got stuck around that corner. Somebody helped push me out. So I'm going to walk up the hill and hitch a ride.
So far, the airport is still open. Reporter August Skamenka is there.
Daria, the long lines here at Denver International Airport are already forming this morning as people await word on whether they'll get where they're going. If they're traveling United, they could encounter delays. Last night, 120 flights were canceled. This morning, at least 75 cancellations. The good news, so far, the airport does remain open, but that's as the second half of this system lumbers its way across Colorado.
And the FAA is hoping that the airport will stay open.
If a major airport such as Denver has to shut down, it doesn't just affect those folks who are going in and out of Denver. That's because Denver is a major hub for United Airlines, and their whole system is interconnected. So even if you're not going in and out of Denver, your plane may be coming from Denver, your crew may be coming from Denver, so you should really check with the airlines, especially if you're on United Airlines, to make sure that your flight isn't somehow affected by what's happening in the Rocky Mountains.
ABC's Lisa Stark at FAA headquarters near Washington, D.C. It won't be long. That much we know about Saddam Hussein's upcoming execution.
Prime Minister Maliki was quoted on Iraqi television this morning saying there should be no delay in implementing a sentence, but he said nothing about the timing. Saddam's lawyers say they have been told to prepare to pick up his personal effects, but they do not know when they should do that.
It's ABC's Terry McCarthy in Baghdad. Former President Ford's family and friends gather for a private funeral today. ABC's Brian McCarthy, Brian Rooney in Palm Desert, California.
The church is locked down, sealed off by the Secret Service. The whole neighborhood is blocked off around St. Margaret's Church. This is going to be a private service for about 300 family and friends of the Fords who will be received afterwards by Mrs. Ford.
ABC News.
I am a mountain climber. I'm a college student. And I dance when
I'm
I have
a mother of three. I'm a three-time Wimbledon champion. And I'm just beginning a whole new career. And whether you're an active mom or a pro athlete, we all face the same threat to our lives and health, osteoporosis. That's why I take CitraCal calcium supplements. Because bone loss and osteoporosis are not going to slow me down. I'm Chris Everett. I'm 51. And I am strong.
Tell us about a strong woman you know at StandStrong.com. CitraCal calcium. Stand strong.
Top three resolutions for the new year. Number three, spend less time at the old refrigerator. Should be easy because I'm getting a new one. Number two, be happier. Well, a new spa tub should help with that. And number one, spend less money.
Get special deferred financing store-wide with your Home Depot consumer credit card and get up to a $250 gift card by mail-in rebate with purchase of major appliances over $297. The Home Depot. You can do it. We can help. Rebate offer valid through January 15th in U.S. only. See store for details.
Scottsdale, Arizona picked him up on drug and DUI charges outside a nightclub. They're the heroes, the villains, and role models of 2006, and sometimes they're all three.
President Bush topped the list of biggest heroes, mentioned by 13%, and biggest villains. 25% put him at the top. On the heroes list, Oprah and Jesus tied at 3%. Among the villains, the president got three times as many votes as Osama bin Laden. There was another tie for seventh place between Rosie O'Donnell and Satan. Oprah was the top celebrity role model for one in three people surveyed. Britney Spears was the runaway worst role model, but Paris Hilton got 18% of the vote, and Mel Gibson came in third. The AP and AOL queried more than 1,000 adults for the poll. Richard Cantu, ABC News.
Almost 83% of us made some kind of a charitable donation last year. The Wall Street Journal says it was usually to a religious-based group. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Brandmeier with your WGNU news update for the 9 o'clock hour. In the news this Friday, a landing gear problem forced an emergency landing at Mid-America Airport in Muscoota. Authorities say a small plane landed on its belly in a grassy area near the runway yesterday afternoon when the pilot couldn't get the landing gear into position. The pilot and two passengers on board weren't injured. Service Employees International Union Local 2000 is working to organize University City workers. Union officials say they have the support of UCity Mayor Joe Adams. The union needs at least 30% of employees to sign up before they will be given neutral status and 60% employee participation before being given a full seat at the bargaining table. You need to know the difference between champagne, sparkling wine, and Asti if you're looking for a good bottle for New Year's Eve. Tony Cafazza, the wine steward at Straub's in Clayton, says Asti is much sweeter than champagne. He says if it doesn't come from the Champagne region of France, then it's sparkling wine and not champagne. Finally this hour, those searching for happiness in the new year might want to consider the advice of best-selling author Deepak Chopra. Applying his studied principles of spirituality and mind-body medicine, Chopra explores the mystery of our existence and its significance in our eternal quest for happiness in his new book. Titled Power, Freedom, and Grace, Living from the Source of Lasting Happiness, Chopra says he hopes readers will learn that happiness and success come from those in tune with their place in the universe.
That ease permeates, that effortlessness, that joy, that laughter permeates everything that you do, and with that also comes love and compassion and the desire to help other people. With that comes the ability to realize all your goals.
Chopra says by knowing who we are, we begin to live from the source of lasting happiness, which he says stems from true inner joy. Deepak Chopra is the author of the international bestseller, The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. His new book, Power, Freedom, and Grace, Living from the Source of Lasting Happiness, is in stores now. This WGNU News Report is brought to you by Chaser Plus. Do Chaser hangover pills really work? Yes. Chaser absorbs toxins to help stop hangovers. Take it while you drink to help you wake up feeling great. Buy Chaser at Walgreens, CVS, and GNC. Please drink responsibly. Don't drink and drive. That's your look at local news for the 9 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeier for Radio Free St. Louis.
Good morning, St. Louis. 7 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton with a look at this hour's traffic and weather. This hour's traffic is sponsored by Open from American Express. All your approaches into the Poplar Street Bridge, you can expect the final push for delays as you're rolling into downtown during rush hour. Westbound Kingbridge traffic is moving well from the Illinois Bank into downtown as well. Westbound 270 into Missouri side from the Illinois side. Expect no delays. Other than that, you may see some ongoing road construction projects. If so, just slow down and give yourself a break and reduce your speed and watch for construction workers. This hour's traffic has been sponsored by Open from American Express. Open, how American Express serves small business. To learn more, visit open.com or call 1-800. Now open. Now taking a look at your WGNU forecast for today, tomorrow, and for the last day of the year, Sunday. For today, mostly cloudy, high in the upper 50s this evening. Chance of showers after midnight, low in the upper 40s. For Saturday, cloudy, chance of showers in the morning and afternoon. The highs will be in the 50s. And Sunday, look for cloudy skies, chance of showers, high in the lower 50s. Currently, we have cloudy conditions and 41 degrees. Lambert Field is reporting 42. Stay tuned for more of the best of the wake-up call. It's up next. We'll take another look at your news and your weather in the 10 o'clock hour. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you and people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
Say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother.
Truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty.
Now more of the best of the wake-up call.
Tax time. I'm sorry if I'm going to be the first person to tell you it's tax time. We're going to take a couple of minutes here to talk about choices many people face when they are trying to get their taxes done. I'm going to talk to Deborah Ortz, the Director of Family Income at the Children's Defense Fund, joining us from Washington, D.C. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning, Liz.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
A lot of people think that during tax time they can go to their tax preparers and instead of waiting for their money to come to them, that it makes sense to and get these immediate cash advances on their taxes. Is this a good idea?
Well, certainly we're seeing lots of ads more and more these days for rapid refunds and fast loans that people can get their taxes back quickly. And, you know, that is certainly an option for people, but those are actually loans that people are taking out. They're short-term loans that have an interest rate. We've seen loans as much as 700% of APR.
Oh, so, for crying out loud, 700%?
That's right. Up to 700%. So it certainly ranges. It ranges from 40% to 700%.
So is it, if I may interrupt just for a second, what is the lowest that you have seen?
We've seen the 40% to 700%, and that's justified by the paid preparer stating that it's a short-term loan. So different rules apply to those short-term loans. And so unfortunately, very low-income families are paying those extraordinarily high interest rates in exchange just to get their returns a few days quicker than they might have if they just waited for the IRS check.
Well, and we're seeing, just like in the market for drugs, that we're seeing a whole lot of commercials for people telling people this is the drug that you should be using, your drug you've never heard of before, but for this commercial, and then people are compelled to go to their doctors and ask for this drug because they saw a commercial for it. We're seeing a lot of commercials directed towards people and their income tax that ask for your money right away. Get your money right away because we can get it to you right away. But we're not hearing about how much it's going to cost you to get your money right away.
That's right. And so people are going and spending hundreds of dollars. Actually, I just here in D.C., we did a press event with our local congresswoman and a tax preparer who paid $320 to get her taxes done and still needed to go cash her check at her local bank and still needed to wait another 5 days to get her money. So certainly, you know, she didn't even get it quicker. She just paid an extraordinary amount of money. When there are other options out there.
And what are the other options for people?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, I should say that these refund anticipation loans are, there's lots of data out there that shows that they are targeting low-income families. 80% of taxpayers who pay our refund anticipation loans make less than $35,000 a year. So these are certainly people that shouldn't be paying these extraordinary fees. That same population can go and obtain free tax preparation from a volunteer income tax assistance site that works very closely with the IRS and is trained to prepare these kinds of simple returns. Also, similar to the story I just told you, one of the barriers to people getting their tax returns quickly is that they don't have an established bank account. And so they have to wait, or they're paying other kinds of fees by going to check cashing play outlets or things like that. So just having the ability to have the IRS send you your check direct deposit to a bank account is a way to really expedite getting those refunds.
But what if you don't have a checking account? Can you do that? Can you go through the IRS with a quicker refund?
The IRS checks received from, you know, the government, an IRS check is certainly your ability to cash that at a bank or even a check cashing place and obtain that quicker without waiting those days that you have to wait for like a check from a company to clear.
Mm-hmm.
So even that would come quicker than if you had a check from a tax preparer.
So what you're saying, Deborah, is that when a lot of low-income people go in and get their checks, get a RAL, the refund anticipation loan, the piece of paper that they get, the check that they get, is not from the IRS. The check that they get is from whatever company expedited or prepared for their refund, their RAL.
Right, because that refund, that RAL, that money that they're getting is actually a loan. That's not the IRS money. So the company is giving the taxpayer those funds in lieu of getting the IRS dollars.
So there will be a hold on that. So if you take a check from a business to your bank, the bank is going to respond to that check differently than a check that they get from the United States government.
Right, and certainly each bank has their own policies, but it does overall take longer for that to get cashed. And also because it is a loan, there's other, you know, aspects that can come in if, let's say, the return was done incorrectly or the IRS is auditing the family, as is very likely this year for EITC recipients in particular, or something is going to happen with their tax return and that money takes longer to come through, then the company that provided them that fast money isn't getting it from the IRS. And so that loan can actually increase because now it's longer than they anticipated. So it can actually, in severe circumstances, put a family at greater risk and make them owe more money than somebody who's earning $35,000 a year would likely, you know, anticipate or be able to afford.
So why are they able to do this?
Well, there's no regulations at this point that prohibit, you know, the ability for companies to do this, provide this very expensive service.
And the idea of the RALs was what? What's the philosophy behind them?
Well, if you look at it from the corporation standpoint or the tax paid prepare standpoint, it does provide a service to people where they can get their funds same day, next day, or within 2 days. You know, and so families who need their tax returns much more quickly can get that much more quickly. While that's true, with other funds, like if you look at Social Security, there's specific regulation which prohibits them from being able to take loans out against Social Security benefits just to protect against circumstances like this. So certainly policies such as that should be used to protect low-income taxpayers.
When we talk about the numbers of people that are affected by these RALs, how many people are we talking about?
Actually, there were over 12 million taxpayers who got refund anticipation loans in the 2003. That's the latest data that we have. And that took out an estimated $1.4 billion from taxpayer hands. And again, of those people who paid for refund anticipation loans, almost 80% of them earned less than $35,000 a year. And even half of those people are families that received the earned income tax credit, which means, again, that they're households with children, most likely households with children who are earning below that amount.
So what are you asking for? What is the Children's Defense Fund asking that happen?
Well, the Children's Defense Fund has been working closely with Senators Akaka and Bingaman of Akaka of Hawaii and Bingaman of New Mexico, as well as Representative Schakowsky from Illinois, who have put forth legislation called the Taxpayer Abuse Prevention Act. And what this legislation would do would be essentially prohibit tax preparers, paid tax preparers, from taking out these very high interest loans against low-income families and using as sort of a threshold the concept that, you know, this is not new. They do this with other programs such as Social Security. So that's what the Children's Defense Fund has been doing. And a lot of our state CDF does have state offices, and our state offices have been trying to get similar types of legislation passed within their states to help protect low-income taxpayers.
And what I guess one of the things that makes these types of loans, the 40% interest rate to up to 700% interest rate, is the nature of the money that we're dealing with. You're going to get your money from the federal government. So what is the risk that these companies are taking in issuing these loans?
Well, the risk is that, you know, there might be an offset to the person's tax return. So, for example, if a parent owed child support or some other government funding. So, however, they do have a way to check that. So they are able to check to see if there's any outstanding, at this point anyway.
That's their job to do that.
That's right.
They are preparing the loan, so they're supposed to be doing that anyway.
That's right. Well, right. So in other words, right, there is no...
It's not like taking out a loan for somebody that has poor credit. It's not like taking out a loan for somebody that, you know, for a business and the business fails and then the person has to pay that loan back. There is, comparatively speaking, far less risk in these little loans than there are in most little loans out there.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I was just trying to be both sides of the fence. But exactly. These are low-income people who work all year, who work for not a lot of money, and at this time of the year, they can get their tax returns, which help, you know, studies show that people use their, specifically the earned income tax credit refund for things like rent and utilities and clothing and food, and that's what families are supposed to be using it for, to help them sustain their families and provide the necessities, not pay extraordinary fees during tax time for a company that's really just taking advantage of an opportunity to take excessive funds from families, low-income families.
And I think that that's a reason why you see so many of these businesses popping up in certain parts of urban areas or certain parts of rural areas, because they know that there is people need their money. People that are earning that kind of income and raising families need their money right away.
That's right, and they're taking advantage of it. And we've also found that in many low, and if you look at many states, these services pop up much more in low-income neighborhoods than they do in any other neighborhood. And that just goes to show who they're targeting and why.
Can anybody say how much money these companies are making off of the interest that they charge for these RALs?
I don't have that figure in front of me, but I can tell you that one particular firm, specifically their EITC population, for their tax returns, the EITC population represents over a third of their revenue, and so they certainly benefit greatly from providing these kinds of services.
And in terms of tax preparation companies providing the services, have you seen any companies change their policies about this?
Well, there are some, you know, for example, H&R Block has put on their website information about refund anticipation loans. And so if you bothered to go to the website to research it, you can probably find some information there about what your choices are. But that information certainly isn't available if I walk into the it hasn't been available to my knowledge. If I walk into the storefront and I go to get my taxes prepared, they're not telling me necessarily, oh, you have other options. You can, A, get this done for free. You can wait an extra few days and get it, you know, get your money just, you know, by waiting a few extra days and save yourself $100 or $200.
And they haven't changed their the amount of interest that they're charging either, have they?
No, they haven't.
And in terms of a correlation, is there a correlation between the income of a family and access to the Internet facilities?
There is. Low-income families still don't have as much access.
They call that a digital divide.
Yes, that's right.
So the fact that H&R has it on their website really doesn't get to the population that needs that information.
No, it really doesn't.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Deborah, for joining us here on the Wake Up Call to bring us that important information during tax time.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Do you have a website that people can go to and find out more about this?
We do have information on our website at childrensdefense.org.
Childrensdefense.org. Deborah
Ortz,
right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Liz.
Listen, folks, we're going to take a break. My name is Liz Brown. This is the Wake Up Call. We have much, much, much to talk about. Stay with me. We are not done. 454-0400 is my
Stick phone. Around for more of the best of the Wake Up Call. Next, we'll take another look at your news and your weather in the 10 o'clock hour.
past several years, you've heard WGNU's community calendar of events going on in and around the area. Ever wonder where the information comes from? The majority of it comes from our listening audience. If your nonprofit organization would like help promoting its events and ongoing operations free of charge, send all necessary information to calendar@WGNU.net. Please send the correspondence 2 weeks prior to any events. WGNU reserves the right to edit or reject submissions for reasons of time and content.
Looking for time made just for you? Wanting to hear from some young people who are cool and well-informed? Have some questions adults just can't seem to answer? There is a place for you on WGNU Radio. Tune in Sunday nights at 5:30. You'll hear teens talk about stuff teens understand. Find out about the latest in music, sports, and other issues that matter. Finally, a talk show for teens, about teens, by teens on 9:20 a.m. 5:30 Sunday nights. Sponsored by the St. Charles Lawanga Center.
Starting January 4th, be sure to tune in every Thursday morning from 11 to noon to It's Your Money, presented by Heartland Bank. Join me, David Gaines, your host, as we discuss the topics that most affect you and your money. We'll have interesting guests that can give you real, usable knowledge about your money. That's every Thursday morning starting January 4th for It's Your Money on 920 WGNU.
Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated, member NASD, SIPC. David Gaines, representative of Heartland Bank and Securities America, are unaffiliated. Securities have no bank guarantees and are not FDIC insured and may lose value.
What you need to know, when you need to know it. The award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now more of the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Of Iraq. And I look at this election in Iraq that has cost this country $300 billion. That's just a number that you can't even wrap your mind around. You can't. You just cannot wrap your mind around that number. And when you add into that the thousands of lives, the thousands of difficult lives that our soldiers are going to have to live after being called in to serve in this Iraq. And then you look at the election. That after $300 billion and thousands of lives and thousands of families destroyed, you look at the election and nobody in America wanted this, or nobody in this administration wanted one. And so when you look at the cost of this war and where we are, it just gives you pause and it begs the question of why. And we can't just focus on the $300 billion. We have to focus on the soldiers as well. Surely, given the $300 billion expenditure, part of that money is going to help our soldiers who are lucky enough to make it back. Surely, part of that $300 billion is going to that. I have with me this morning Joe Violante, the National Legislative Director of Disabled American Veterans, joining us from Washington, D.C., to tell us how veterans are faring with the budget that has been introduced by this administration. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Liz. How are you doing?
I'm outstanding. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a former Marine, served during the Vietnam War. I've been with Disabled American Veterans now for some 15 years, and prior to that worked as a staff attorney over at the Board of Veterans Appeals, Department of Veterans Affairs. So I have 20 or some years working in the veterans arena.
And not only, you're not just involved with the veterans.
I'm also involved with several bar associations that have veterans committees.
And you've also had your own television show to talk about veterans issues.
That's right. And I sit on the Board of Directors for National Foundation for Women Legislators, and I understand recently you received an award from them.
Yes, I did. So, I wanted to put your resume out there. I wanted people to feel a sense of who you are before we begin this discussion, because as I said in the opening, surely some of this $300 billion that this war has cost us so far, surely a lot of that and the right amount of that has gone to help our veterans returning home from war.
Actually, none of that goes to veterans. That money is used to prosecute this war, to ensure that, you know, our troops have the proper equipment and munitions, and their needs are met. You know, what I think a lot of people don't understand is there's a continuing cost of war, and that's not factored into that. And that's to, you know, care for those young men and women, those brave young men and women who come home sick and disabled.
And sometimes come home and then get sent right back and
exactly.
come home again.
They've been recycling a lot of these young men and women between Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's a shame.
When we look at this administration's budget for the VA, because there are a lot of articles that are coming out now talking about the fact that the wounded that are coming back from these two occupations are unlike wounded that the VA has seen before.
Right. The extent of some of these injuries are pretty severe, and the reason for that is the fact that the body armor that these young men and women wear today, much better than we had during Vietnam or earlier. And so while it's saving their lives, they're losing limbs, they're having pretty extensive head injuries that they're surviving. So
their medical needs are far more extensive than other vets.
Correct. And we're seeing also an increase in the veterans that are returning with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, this war, you know, somewhat similar to Vietnam in the sense that you're not really sure who it is you're fighting, and you have to deal with that. And I think that creates additional problems. I think the one thing that makes this war a little worse than Vietnam is that it's being fought in the cities and not out in the rice paddies.
And insofar as the psychological impact and effect of this war on our soldiers, given all of the division in this country about whether or not we should be in this place at this time, does that add to it? Does that add to the psychological issues of our soldiers?
You know, to some degree, I think the one thing that these men and women have going for them is I think they know that the American public supports them. They may not support the war, but they do support the men and women. And I think back during Vietnam, society had a difficult time separating the war from the warrior, and they don't have that problem today. But I'm sure the fact that there is some opposition to the war probably has an impact.
So when we look at the budget that this administration has put together for this for our soldiers that have greater medical needs, that have greater psychological needs, and it's difficult to get a job out there as well, and have different economic needs, how well does this budget meet the needs of our soldiers?
Doesn't come close. About 2 years ago, the Undersecretary for Health at the Department of Veterans Affairs testified that VA needs about a 13 to 14% increase in their health care budget annually.
2 years ago?
Yes, and the current Undersecretary has basically said the same thing. This year's health care budget is a 1% increase. So do the math. We're short by 12 to 13% in the health care arena. Since the war started in 2003 in Iraq, VA has lost almost, again, if this budget goes through as proposed, we'll have lost about 600 full-time employees in the Veterans Benefits Administration, those individuals that working the claims, education claims, insurance claims. So, you know, it's going in the wrong direction.
I want to have a little conversation about that statistic. Please break down what that means to a soldier coming back from Iraq. a soldier who served in Vietnam, a soldier that served in Korea, that we now have 600 fewer people to process their claims.
Right. It means it's going to take longer to process these claims. It probably means that these claims are not going to be done correctly the first time. You know, there's an effort in VA to look at the processing time and to try to get the processing time down. And what happens is quality goes out the window. And so while they may be trying and unsuccessfully trying to get the processing time down, what it's doing is it's forcing the quality of these decisions to go down, forcing VA to have to re-adjudicate these cases over and over again to try to get them correct. So it delays the process, it prolongs it, it prevents these individuals from getting their claims worked quickly and getting their earned compensation in a timely fashion.
And it costs us more money if they have to be continually adjudicated.
Exactly.
So, and from what I have heard, my father is a veteran, a retired colonel in the Special Forces, and from what I have, my experience is that it wasn't that the VA was able to successfully deal with the claims that were being made anyway.
No, you're correct. They've had a struggle. They've made some headway every now and then. Under Secretary Principe, put a lot of emphasis on trying to get the quality up, trying to get the timeliness down, the processing time down. But the lack of resources, and again, you know, 600 employees will have been lost, so it's tough.
And I guess one of the issues that I would like for you to explain to our audience is, what is the promise that is made to a service person when they sign up to be in the military? Is that promise different today than it was when my father signed up in 1953?
Well, you know, it's interesting because going back to my experiences in you know, when I enlisted in 69, I don't remember many promises being made. I don't remember thinking about, well, what would happen to me if. The only thing I do remember is when it came time to talk about reenlisting, promises were made at that point about health care. Back in 53, however, certainly there's been some litigation about it, and I think the courts have acknowledged that certain promises were made prior to 1956. However, the courts have shied away from doing anything about it and referred it back to Congress. So, I mean, there was always, I think, the implied promise that the government would take care of you should something arise out of your military service, and they're just not fulfilling that promise.
And I want to talk about some of the specifics of what our soldiers have to pay now, but we have to take a break. I am talking to Joe Violante, the National Legislative Director of Disabled American Veterans. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. We're talking about the state of our veterans as it pertains to this current budget. My name is Liz Brown. This is The Wake Up Call. Please stay with us. We have much, much, much to talk about.
You're listening to the best of The Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Stick around for more. We'll get next.
Hi, this is now Hall of Famer Wade Boggs, and I'd like to talk to you about another exclusive group that I belong to that has changed my life. I'm talking about the thousands of guys who, just like me, have decided to take control of their hair loss and regrow their hair permanently with the pros at Medical Hair Restoration. The best thing about this club is that you see the rewards every day. Having my hair back has made me look and feel younger than I have in years. And that's the ultimate vote of confidence.
If you're balding or thinning, Medical Hair Restoration, the nation's leader in microsurgical hair transplantation, wants to send you a free DVD package explaining just how easy and painless their hair replacement procedure is. Call 800-410-1832. That's 800-410-1832. Take control of your hair loss and get this free information package sent to you with tons of before and after pictures and testimonials. There's no cost, no obligation. Call 800-410-1832. That's 800-410-1832.
Nothing can be truer than the phrase, all politics is local. That's why Liz Brown is adding the Aldermanic Watch to the award-winning Wake Up Calls lineup. Every Monday at 7 a.m., Liz will be joined by Alderman Lewis Reed to discuss the comings and goings of the St. Louis Board of Aldermen. Do you want to know the latest bill passed? Do you want to know why it passed? And do you want to know who voted for and who voted against? Well, you're going to have to join Liz Brown when she talks Aldermanic politics with Alderman Lewis Reed every Monday at 7 a.m. Lewis Reed is going to bring local politics up close and personal, and you never know who else will be joining the discussion. The Aldermanic Watch, every Monday at 7 a.m., only on the award-winning Wake Up Call.
This is your WGNU Global News Update. Dateline Mogadishu. Somali forces and their Ethiopian allies have taken control of the Somali capital of Mogadishu. Their Islamist rivals abandoned the war-torn city after holding it for 6 months. The fall of Mogadishu comes about 10 days after the Islamists looked to march onto a Somali government base. That prompted Ethiopia to come openly into the war, proving to be a key in helping save the government and pushing back the Islamists. Once the move happened, some Mogadishu residents greeted the government troops in the streets of the city. There were some parts of the city that erupted in gunfire, and there were some minor outbreaks of looting. It is unclear what the next steps will be for the Islamist group. Some war analysts fear the group will launch a protracted guerrilla campaign. There are also questions among some experts as to whether the Somalia government can maintain security if the Ethiopians leave. This is your WGNU Global News Update, sponsored by Reasonable Construction.
Hi, I'm Laurie Falkerson, inviting you to join me every Monday morning at 10 on AM 920 WGNU. You'll hear stories of people just like you who are overcoming obstacles and making a difference in the lives of others. You're invited to share your thoughts. You know people are what matter most to me, and I enjoy talking with you and helping you reach your highest goals. Join me for the Laurie Falkerson Show, Monday morning at 10 on AM 920 WGNU. We're here to discuss what matters most to you.
This is Sergeant Gary Wiggard. Don't touch that dial. Step away from the radio. Why? Because I'm next.
Bad boy, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
Big Brother is watching, and we're watching Big Brother on the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Stick around for more of the best of the Wake Up Call right now on AM 920 WGNU.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. My email is lizbrown, L-I-Z-Z, B-R-O-W-N, at sbcglobal.net. I am talking to Joe Violante, the National Legislative Director of Disabled American Veterans, joining us from Washington, D.C. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you.
The reason I asked you the question before our last break there about what was the promise made to our veterans is because
I'm seeing veterans do something that I didn't think that they were ever supposed to do, and that's pay for services out of their own pocket. And that's what this new budget that by this administration would have veterans do, is it not?
Exactly. And they've proposed those now for a number of years, but have been defeated in Congress. This year, I'm not sure we're going to be successful. And what they're asking for are certain veterans will be required to pay a $250 enrollment fee for health care and also increase co-payments for their pharmaceutical needs from $7 to $15.
Now, I don't have to pay a $15 co-payment. This just seems so wrong.
It is, and it's designed for one purpose, and that is to drive these veterans out of the VA healthcare system, to shrink the system, because the administration and Congress are just unwilling to provide the necessary funds to care for all those who are currently enrolled.
And when we talk about that all those that are currently enrolled, what kind of numbers are those?
It's about 7 million veterans out of a total population of about 24 million veterans who are currently enrolled for VA. Back in January of 2003, the secretary was forced to make a decision to exclude the lowest priority groups, which are priority group 8 veterans, and those are veterans who make more than $25,000 to $30,000. Annually, depending on where they live. If they hadn't enrolled prior to January of 2003, they were excluded and prevented from coming to the system now to enroll.
So what was the highest number, the highest ratio of veterans using the VA system?
I think the users are probably a little over 4 million or about close to 5 million. But right now the total enrolled is probably the highest it's ever been, and that's, as I said, 7 million.
And what's the projected cost of that?
Well,
I mean, when Congress sits down and crunches the numbers for what this is going to cost us, what are they saying?
They're looking for health care, roughly about $24 billion.
So when we have a health care system like this that is only treating the very, very sickest and only treating the poorest, what kind of quality of health care are veterans going to get?
It's going to drive the quality down, unfortunately. I mean, back in 1996, Congress passed legislation that changed the way VA delivered health care, as well as opening the system up to all veterans. And we saw the quality of VA health care just a skyrocket. I mean, people were satisfied with the health care they were receiving. VA, since that time, has been acknowledged as one of the best health care providers in the country. But as we start, you know, forcing VA to only take care of, as you said, you know, the sickest of the sick and the poorest of the poor, we're going to watch that quality go down. We're going to see VA probably starting to cut back on a full continuum of care that veterans can receive now, and that's not good.
How are veterans organizations responding to this? Because the sense that I get is there's not a whole lot of noise from veterans organizations, because maybe because we're in a war right now and they don't want to appear that they are opposing the commander-in-chief?
Well, I think all the veterans organizations are united in our efforts to get an adequate level of funding for VA health care. In fact, I think most of us believe that the president's budget falls short by about $3.5 billion for health care alone. And are pushing to see that increased in Congress. Again, I think this year is going to be a really hard battle. Everyone is looking at cutting programs as opposed to providing adequate resources.
But, Joe, I just, as a journalist, as an observer, as a person that's lived in this country for a few years, it doesn't seem possible that the VA, a person like you, a person that is a legislative director of disabled American veterans during the time of war, that it would be difficult for you all to give more money for veterans.
You know, it's amazing. I thought last year, you know, again, being a presidential election, our nation at war, that we would have an easy time, but last year was probably one of the hardest years to get an adequate level of funding, and this year's going to be worse, and you're right, it's amazing.
Well, why is it harder? Why is it harder?
Well, because I think many in the administration and in Congress are concerned about the increasing deficit and are unfortunately looking at some of our most needed programs to cut to try to reduce that deficit, and it's forcing some really tough decisions, and unfortunately I don't think that veterans are a priority with our government right now, and therefore they're not providing the level of resources that we need.
Well, you represent an organization that's what, 1.2 million
yes.
members. How far are you all willing to go to get what should be done?
As far as we need to. We've united with the other veterans organizations, formed a partnership of 9 veteran service organizations that are fighting now to try to change the way they fund VA healthcare. Right now it's a discretionary funding system, and that means that it's at the discretion of Congress how much money they provide us. We're trying to move it over to the mandatory side to ensure that those veterans who want to come to VA and use the services can do so, and that VA receives a sufficient level of funding to care for those men and women who do want to use VA.
Are you all considering any kind of television ad campaign to expose what our veterans are going to face if these budgets go through as proposed?
Well, there are a number of avenues we're looking at.
Because
right
America,
now,
do you think that America really knows this, that you all are being stonewalled, or you all are being treated in this way?
No, I don't believe the American public would tolerate it if they did know. And one of our plans is to start doing town hall meetings and rallies around the country to try to make the American public aware of the fact that, you know, veterans are not being treated properly. I think they see stories on TV, the president and members of Congress going up to Walter Reed and, you know, shaking hands with the wounded, and those men and women are getting excellent care through the military facilities. But, you know, once the military cuts them loose and they come to the VA system, they're going to have to stand in lines behind us older generations of veterans that are trying to get services. So it's not going to be a good situation, and hopefully we can get the word out to the American public and they can express their outright indignation.
Joe, I swear to you, three good commercials would really change the world on this, because the American people don't know. They have absolutely no clue. Let me take a caller here. Your car phone, Will, on a car phone.
Yeah, how you doing, Liz?
Yep.
Good morning.
Good morning.
To hear your voice this morning. And you always have a delicious conversation and great guests every time I pick up the radio and turn it on. But I'm glad you got a VA representative there talking about the benefits, because I was speaking about that about 2 weeks ago. And I just wanted him to cover some of the issues. You said, was he aware, or do the American people know about it? Look what they did to us in Vietnam. They weren't that concerned about our benefits, and once the war was over, it was something that was just lost in the back burner, and the way they handle the files and medical situations at VA is pathetic, because they just keep it on the burner, and they hope we turn around and pass or stop fighting for it or die off. And it's sad, but they need to make some changes. This is 2005. It's time they start updating the insurance and not only the benefits. The only great resource I know that they do have is for substance abuse. And they, for 6 months, you can go down there, and they'll give you a beautiful place to stay, a room, and try to get you on your feet and help you get a job. But other than that, as far as the medical situation, it's sad. They put it on the back burner, and you got vets from Vietnam right now that have really serious situations, and they're still trying to fight for it, not only the benefits, medical situations, and they only treat the most serious urgent situation, like I say, they'll cut a leg off to keep you from getting cancer when all they got to do is plug out a piece of it.
Thanks for your call, Will. And Joe, the thing that you said that I think addresses some of what Will's comments were is that it's a little different in 2005 with the support of the American people.
Right. They support the troops. You see support the troop bumper stickers all over the place. But what we need to do is make sure the American public understands that, you know, we also need to support veterans in the programs once they're transitioned out of the military.
Because a magnet on the back of your bumper of your car doesn't support the troops, but a call to your congressperson about VA veterans would.
That's correct. And we were hoping that more and more Americans will start doing that because that's the only way Congress pays attention. You know, unfortunately, veterans organizations can't provide a voting block. We don't have PAC funds or campaign funds that we can donate. The only thing we have is the services that we provided in the past to ensure that, you know, we remain a free country. And like I said, when that falls on deaf ears, then we have some serious problems.
We're going to take another break. I'm talking to Joe Violante, National Legislative Director of Disabled American Veterans. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. We'll get to your calls. A lot of you have some calls and questions that you want to ask Joe.
Well, you've been listening to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Stick around for Gary Wigert. He's up next. This is AM 920.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how can you stand?
It is time for us to use our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how can
you listen? But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
Struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.